The Place to Be podcast is now a proud member of the History of WWE.com website. The History of WWE.com features thousands of complete cards and detailed results from throughout wrestling history for major multiple promotions, in addition to outstanding columns and reviews. It is now also the official home of the Place to Be podcast and Scott and Justin's pay-per-view reviews. Visit us at thehistoryofwwe.com or on Facebook by searching for the Place to Be podcast or the History of WWE, because the Place to Be is now the History of WWE.
Now, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard? Not billiards. It was...
Come on, Rudy.
Come on. We call it
the place to be.
The place to be, yes.
It's the place to be. Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can...
Time to play the game!
Well, you always left me satisfied and smiling, so...
That's what she said!
Why do I want this?
Yeah.
Because I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, it is now time for the Place to Be podcast. And now your hosts, Justin Rosero and Scott Friscolo.
Just for the house. Come on. The styling is creative. Flashy above the native. Can't be violated or even deceptive. I got problems in the jungle.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to another great episode of the Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero. And joining me, as always, is the man who never gets with this nor that, and that is Scott Criscolo. Scott, how you doing?
Good evening, Mr. Rosero, and good evening, everyone. We are at the Double Nickel tonight,
yes.
Episode number 55 of the Place to Be podcast, and it is a very, very special Place to Be podcast. We'll tell you why in a sec. Since I said Double Nickel, I will refer to that game in 1995 at Madison Square Garden when Michael Jordan came back and dropped the Double Nickel on the Knicks.
I will obviously go with Hideki Matsui.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Russell Martin.
No, you got to go with Matsui.
Godzilla. You got to go with Godzilla. That is true. That is true. Speaking of Godzilla, that's the enormity of our guest tonight.
Yes.
It is a tremendous honor tonight to have our guest on. And our listeners have been asking, waiting. The moment has finally arrived. My friend, why don't you bring him in?
Of course. That is wrestler extraordinaire. He's been across many multiple promotions, witnessed a lot of history. And a very gracious guest to come on and help us out here tonight, and that is, of course, Stevie Richards. Stevie, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And first off, I want to say I'm very impressed with the audio quality of your podcast. Not my voice. I'm sorry. It's shot from Comic-Con in Chicago, but your mics and your sound and your setup sounds very impressive.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll let our producer know, maybe.
If we had one, we would tell him, and he would be proud.
Yes.
So, Stevie, we just wanted to kind of go through your career today and talk about some of the highs and lows and get your different impressions of a variety of things, and not even just your career, maybe some other observations as well, since you have been through a lot of wrestling history over the last 15 to 20 years. So I figured we'd jump right into it, and the first question we wanted to get into, we'll let Scott lead off. Go ahead,
yeah,
Scott.
I'll throw the first pitch, thank you. It's an honor, Stevie, because you're one of the few guys over the last 20 years that have actually crossed all four of the major promotions, WWE, WCW, ECW, old and new, and, of course, TNA. But why don't we start at the beginning? What drew you to wrestling growing up as a kid? You just pop it on one day and saw it. What got you into enjoying wrestling when you were a kid?
Well, to tell you the truth, when I was really young, my older brother Steven was because my real name is Michael Mattis, so my older brother Steven was actually a wrestling fan, and we used to always fight because I wanted to watch Spider-Man and Friends on Fox in Philadelphia, and he wanted to watch WWE. I forget what the show was. I think it was, I have no idea, but it was Saturday Morning Wrestling. So somehow that influenced me very early. One day I just decided to sit down with him and watch it, and I really liked it. I liked the not knowing it as a kid, but just good versus evil, the drama of it and the athleticism, and never thought in a million years that I would ever be able to do that because I was a very nerdy, geeky kid, not very athletic or anything. And I think one day someone told me I couldn't do it. And that's kind of where I'll show you, you'll see came from way back when I was at the young age of 14 years old.
Now, what were some of your favorites when you first started watching? Were you a Hulkamaniac like the rest of us, or did you kind of gravitate towards the bad guys? Who were some of your favorites when you first started watching?
Being in Philadelphia, obviously, we're exposed to just WWF at the time. So it was Hulk Hogan, Paul Orndorff, those guys way back in the mid-80s, you know, right around the time of WrestleMania 1. And the NWA came on the air, and I remember seeing Paul Jones and his army jump Jimmy Valiant, who I had no idea who they were, but it just had such a different look and feel to it. And I caught the end of the show, and everybody knows who watched NWA back then. They had some of the best, most exciting cliffhanger endings that you could see on TV, and something I miss about the business these days. I hate that they don't leave it just so chaotic at the end and go off the air because they're, quote, out of time. Mm-hmm. But you know, that exposed me to a different part of it. You know, obviously the standard Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, those kinds of guys. But I really was a fan of Shawn Michaels even back when he was with the Rockers. There was an intensity. And obviously with them being a very exciting tag team, I liked teams like them, like the Rock and Roll Express. I actually wasn't really a fan of the Road Warriors because I couldn't identify with them because I was just a skinny little guy. So obviously the Rock and Roll Express and the Midnight Rockers and the Rockers were two sets of teams that I could actually identify with on a personal level.
Well, because you are talking, Stevie, to the biggest Road Warriors fan.
I'm glad you said that, Stevie, just to tweak them. Thank you.
Because we're going to have to cut you off now. Have a good night. No, I'm only kidding. So was there one match that stuck out for you as a kid? Like, I remember when I was a kid, the match that stuck out for me was Jimmy Snuka and Magnificent Rocco at the Garden in the Cage. That was the match that hooked me. Was there one match that just stuck out for you when you first watched as a kid saying, that's it, I want to do that?
Yeah, I know the exact time. And actually, I have a funny story about Jim Cornette because it was September 10th, 1988. I went to my one and only live event because I didn't have much money as a kid growing up, so couldn't really afford to go to the live events. But I went to a NWA live event at the Philly Convention Center, I believe. And September 10th, 1988 is when the Midnight Express were U.S. Tag Team Champions and beat Tully and Arn for the NWA World Tag Team titles. And I walked home that night all the way from the Philly Convention Center saying, that's what I want to do for a living.
And wow.
And Cornette says, don't blame that on him.
Which is funny because we, as we mentioned in the open, Justin and I do pay-per-view written reviews, and we're actually doing NWA reviews. And I believe that's coming up very soon, as a matter of fact. And maybe we'll see you in the crowd if you're on the tape. So Cornette, so that's pretty interesting because, like you said, I'm from Connecticut, so I remember the same thing as you. There wasn't a lot of outlets for other promotions besides, you know, the WWF programming, dating myself, and NWA. Did you catch anything? Was there anything else you caught? Maybe like the tail end of AWA on ESPN. What were some other promotions that caught your eye through the dial when you were a kid?
I watched AWA. I watched World Class when it was on ESPN. I found World Class. It was always kind of weird how the ring sounded muted. There wasn't a lot of impact. The camera work was very static. I was always a geek at heart, so I was always looking at video production, audio production. Mm-hmm. I really liked the UWF. That was sort of reminding me of what ECW was before ECW came around. UWF was just out there, exciting, hardcore, and what they were doing back then, people that have become like family to me, people like Terry Taylor, to grow up watching him and in that sort of environment and that sort of time, and then listening to the stories that he tells about what it was like to work there. It was very similar to what it was like in ECW, except Bill Watts was, from what I hear, a really, really disciplined man and came down hard on the talent. Paul was very open and let you be yourself and let you succeed or fail on your own.
Well, that's definitely part of the trouble Bill Watts ran into when he took over WCW as well. A lot of that didn't really fly coming into such a lax atmosphere. UWF, though, that's definitely the one promotion it seems like a lot of fans definitely are kind of clamoring for more. I know there's a lot of footage out there you can buy, but that's the one library seems Vince McMahon can't get his hands on. One that could maybe, you know, benefit from a lot of exposure to current fans and younger fans that maybe didn't get to experience it at the time.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, maybe Watts is just smart and he wants to hold out for more money since he knows it's the last library. I don't know if he owns it or...
I think it's his wife, right? There's some nonsense in there with the
divorce. Yeah, he lost it in a divorce settlement or something. I think his wife's got it.
Yeah, I wasn't there, and I don't know Mr. Watts or anybody in that era besides the workers from that era, so I couldn't comment on that.
Okay, Stevie, so coming up as a fan, like you said, you got in a little late thanks to your brother, became a big fan. How did you go about breaking into the business? Now, I know you trained with Iron Mike Sharp School. How did you get hooked up with Mike Sharp and what your experience is there as well?
No, actually, I was. It's been previous to that. I was supposed to be in the very first, one of the first rookie matches in Tri-State Wrestling Alliance, which was the ECW before ECW. Okay. Todd Jordan was the money man. Joel Goodhart ran it. They had a radio show. I went to the school, and I was supposed to be in a rookies match against Eric Domino in probably December 91, January 92. They closed it down, and then Todd started Eastern Championship Wrestling, and I was in the very first match at Michael Jack's Sports Bar in downtown Philadelphia. Very first match of the first ECW event, won 20-minute time limit with Jimmy Jannetty. So
okay.
That was pretty cool. Yeah. But I went to Mike Sharp's, and he, you know, you learn something no matter where you go. If I went to a show and worked somebody that had more time into the business than me or even less, it doesn't matter. Every match, everywhere you go, you always learn. So Mike Sharp did teach me a lot too. He taught me how to get my cardio up in a hurry. He's a pretty much a cardio machine.
So early ECW, any interesting stories? Or, I mean, obviously you saw that whole promotion really develop from being such a small local based indie into, you know, becoming what it became, which is an amazing story in itself. What were those early kind of outlaw days like when it became Tri-State into Eastern, leading up to the changeover to Extreme?
Well, I went away for a little while because there was no work, no bookings for somebody that had no experience. So I just drove to every show I could within reason and tried to work for free. Did it the old-fashioned way. Tried to pay my dues, tried to help set up rings, tried to get to know promoters, just tried to go in and get beat up by whatever name they had on the independent show, that kind of stuff. And same thing with ECW. I just kept showing up every night with my bags, eventually got an opportunity to get chokeslammed by 911 every single night. And then they gave me, I mean, that's the way it was.
Yep.
It wasn't, it, you know, you really did pay your dues back then. I think that was the last real time where guys came in. Didn't feel like paying my dues, just felt like, hey, I'm doing something tonight. That's all I care about. I don't care what it is. And then eventually just get an opportunity. And, you know, you learn a lot outside the ring too, how to conduct yourself. Sometimes the easy way, sometimes I learned the hard way to conduct yourself properly backstage. And unfortunately that's all gone from what I hear nowadays, the etiquette and the courtesy and the respect and stuff like that is almost gone.
So leading up, obviously, you know, you made your return, and when it was announced that Scott Levy would become Raven, of course, someone you were tied to for much of your early part of your career was coming in, you started mocking some of his personas. Was that an idea you came up with, something to kind of make a mark for yourself, or was that something that was, you know, kind of a directive given to you as a gimmick they thought something you could run with? How did that whole thing come about?
Well, Paul came up with all that. I wasn't nowhere near smart enough to, or even had any kind of clout to say what I wanted to do. He just basically knew he was bringing Raven in. He knew he wanted me to be his lackey, and the antithesis between him being cool and me being not cool. And I just wanted an opportunity. I didn't care. I would act like a jackass for as long as they wanted me to. It made me different. ACW is full of tough guys, full of badasses, full of hardcore people. And that's where I actually was smart enough to know, wow, I can be completely different. And Raven reinforced it too. So I wasn't exactly convinced, but he said, you're completely different than anybody else. You'll get more over than anybody else. And to a point, and at one point or another in my career there, he was right.
Now, when you, as you went along in those early mid-90s, 94, 95, 96, when it was just starting to, I mean, I remember the first time I watched ECW, I graduated from college and it was on at 2 o'clock in the morning on MSG. And you know, I wasn't actually watching WWE as a fan myself at the time. And I thought, wow, what is this? It's really strange. And I think you were the first guy I saw. I think you were the opening, clip of that episode, the whole thing with Beulah and then the whole thing with Tommy. And I always liked your nickname, the King of Swing. I stole that for a little while because I always thought that was a cool nickname. Mm. But the gimmick that I think we need to talk about now, and it's probably one of the greatest cult gimmicks ever created, and I think people still think of it very, very highly, and that is, of course, the BWO, otherwise known as the Blue World Order, because obviously by 96 into 97, the NWO was hot in WCW. Who came up with that idea? Was that you? Was that Hollywood Nova? Was it Blue Meanie? Where did that idea come to mock the New World Order in that way?
Well, yeah, Meanie came up with the name Blue World Order, and we kind of figured out the names between us. And I think, no, I'm not sure if Nova got it, the shirts, the white ones with the blue spray paint done first, or if it was Meanie. I mean, I know Nova, we were talking about over a weekend at Chicago Comic Con, because we went there to sign autographs as the BWO. Nova did do the signs, and we did get a bunch of people, my friends, their friends, to come through with the signs. And it was supposed to be a one-off, you know, just like all the other stuff with the Fabulous Ones, with Kiss, with all that stuff. And we didn't think we could even top Kiss. So the BWO thing just kind of, the fans made that pretty much what it is, and the company ran with it. So that those are two integral parts of making the BWO even more, you know, popular after, 15, 16 years?
Mm-hmm. Pretty much. Now, Did you expect it to really get over like it did? You probably figured out you get a good chuckle out of it, most likely. But obviously, the fan base you were working with, those crazies in the bingo hall, obviously hated anything that either WWE or WCW was putting on TV at the time. So did you think it was really going to get that crazy? Or was it like, we'll do this for a few shows and then move on to something else? Did you really expect it to snowball the way it did at that time?
You know what? I mean, it was different back then. It was just show up to the arena, work the shows, just get, I was always in the way where I just want to get booked. I want to work. I want to make money, because if I'm not booked and I'm not working, I'm not making any money. So that's really the most important. Obviously I thought it was cool and I enjoyed it, but in wrestling, you can never rest on your laurels or actually really look forward to anything, because it's kind of completely out of your control after you leave the ring. What happens on the next TV show or the next house show or the next pay-per-view? So I was kind of smartened up to that by Raven.
Speaking of Raven, obviously you and him were very tight in those early years. You guys, pretty much your storylines intertwined. What was your relationship with him at this time, as you two were at your peak in the early days of ECW together? What was your relationship with him like?
Outside the ring?
Or either during the ring or outside the ring, as you guys were going along in those early years, did you guys get along pretty well?
You know, we're two different personalities. Outside the ring, no way. Didn't get along at all. You know, Scotty was in a certain place in his life. I was in a certain place in mine. Not necessarily either one were good. You know, Scotty, of course, it's been well documented about his, you know, his demons and everything that he's overcome, and he's doing great now. And, you know, I was just a young kid and I wasn't exposed to a whole lot of the wrestling stuff, you know, there. So I was sort of shocked every week whenever I saw this kind of behavior. But in the ring, I don't think I've ever had the chemistry with anybody that I've had with Raven. I don't think there's going to be anything that's going to, I mean, you think about it. This is kind of a makeshift tag team put together. Two totally different characters, different, mm-hmm. One's cool, one's not cool. We didn't really mesh well from a personality standpoint. For some reason, it had that it factor, and two-time ECW World Tag Team Champions, and really the centerpiece of the show with Tommy Dreamer and intertwined and all the other stuff going on for how many years? I mean, that kind of stuff is pretty cool. And the unexplainable mystique behind that relationship, I think, is what people really, because people, I think, still want to see on some of these indies, Raven and Stevie Richards team up. I'll be more than happy to put on the old outfit, and, you know, I'm pretty sure it still fits. you know, it, to me, that stuff is cool. And we are really tight today. We are really good friends. And it, because of that time we went through and because of knowing each other, it's sort of like Marines in some ways. I don't know if you've heard that analogy. Wrestlers, it's sort of like being in the Marines. You know, you don't get along, you don't do whatever, or you have your differences, but you're both in the same business. And, you know, when push comes to shove with somebody outside, some outside person, like if somebody attacked another wrestler back then, whether you're a babyface or a heel, the other wrestlers would jump the fan, yeah, and protect their brother in wrestling. And that's what me and Raven, you know, no matter what, even if we didn't get along, we still had each other's back. And today, like I said, we are tighter than ever.
That's something that seemed to be pretty prevalent around that time, honestly, when the Monday Night Wars were kind of cooking and the Attitude Era and all that. It seemed like there was always a fan jumping in the ring trying to get on TV. at that point. So, Stevie, this one thing I wanted to talk about, because I was still in the dark pretty much about ECW in 96, 97. I'd pretty much just got my information out of like PWI or whatever AOL bare bones chat room there was.
Oh, God.
At that time. Trust me, I remember the Yokozuna returning to Raw tonight to defeat Shawn Michaels, all the fake rumors going around. But one of my favorite episodes of Raw ever was from February 97 with the ECW invasion. That was really my first exposure to that and my first exposure to you on any kind of major level. Can you tell us a little bit about that night and what it felt like to invade into Raw and get the reception that you guys got? Because there was a pretty big dichotomy on that show, whereas the WWF guys almost felt old and bland. And when you guys came out, you know, the BWO came out and did their shtick, and then the Eliminators came out, and Sabu dove off the Raw sign. You know, there's a lot of chaos involved when you guys were on. And tell us a little bit about that night, because it seems like probably one of the more memorable ones when it comes to ECW's cross-promotion.
It was, you know, it was pretty cool. And, you know, I tried to be respectful to everybody in WWE at the time, WWF, and go up and shake hands and do that stuff. I remember is so many people in ECW were acting like, you know, why are you kissing their ass? Why are you going up to these guys? They're the enemy, this and that. And I was like, well, God, we're all in the same business. I've seen most of these guys on the indies throughout the 90s, and they're veterans. I have to go up and show them the respect. And, you know, that kind of stuff was, it was sort of like an us versus them attitude, which was a good thing because it motivated everybody to do better. I think that the episode of Raw, I mean, I had some, you know, compared to other guys, I was really blessed to have full match with time. You know, the Eliminators, the Sabu thing where he fell off the R. We always joke about that. You fell off the R. You know, it was rushed because of time and it was live. But I mean, to think it, of all the guys that Paul could have put in there and that Vince could have approved, they actually gave me a full match with me over with my finish that Shawn Michaels was doing on television at the time. It's really kind of weird. I mean, probably got a ton of heat for that, but I wasn't even aware of it back then. What's weird is when I look back on it, I don't know why they cut to a camera angle that's way up in the rafters when I look at the video today of that match, and I completely just took, you know, Nunzio's head off with the kick.
Yes.
I don't know why they cut that shot. It didn't look like crap or anything. It actually looked like I, you know, busted his eardrum with the heel of my boot.
I was just about to bring that up because I remember that's one of the first times I remember, you know, being introduced to your Stevie kick. And that whenever I bring up that show or even just now, that's the first thing I think of is you just, you know, crushing his skull with that kick. It was definitely a real memorable one.
Yeah, I didn't hurt him. But you can't hurt that
guy. Right.
But yeah, I don't know why they cut that camera. It's a mystery today to me. I don't know why. Maybe it was too good.
Well, yeah, they probably didn't want you showing up Shawn Michaels, to be honest, because, you know, he'd get some good ones here and there. But that one definitely always stuck with me when I think of that. That and the total elimination that they had on the referee.
Yeah, I remember that. Well, he can have the better super kick if he gives me his bank account. We'll try.
Precisely.
Even trade. So then coming off of that, of course, the whole cross promotion you guys did with WWF was to promote Barely Legal, your first pay-per-view. And of course, you were involved quite heavily in that show. You know, in the main event picture. Tell us a little bit about the atmosphere behind the scenes in the arena and then your experience, you know, in that match, how you felt being involved in such a major angle.
Nervous would be the one word to describe it, you know, really nervous, you know, with Terry Funk and Sandman being in the same ring as me, especially Terry Funk, and being on pay-per-view and knowing that you have that main stage. And, you know, obviously I wasn't aware back then of any, you know, jealousy or heat. Everybody really wanted to do well and have the other guys do well. I think if that was a WWE or a TNA, and I've seen that throughout the years, you know, there's that jealousy or people trying to stab you in the back. And that's what I think about ECW. Whether or not anybody agreed with me being in that three-way match for the main event for the world title against Raven, they wanted the pay-per-view to do well and they wanted to support me. And I got a lot of support and feedback, even from guys I didn't get along with at the time. And that, what I think would make the pay-per-view even more special was the teamwork, the team effort to make it work. And God was kind of looking down on us because, like, I'm sure you heard the story, the transformer or whatever generator blew 10 seconds after we went off the air. So that could have happened at any time.
Amazing.
That is pretty amazing. And the whole thing about the provider kind of pulling the plug a few months before and Paul talking about how it was just on the DVD about how being all frazzled and got a different kind of a second or third tier pay-per-view company to carry it. It's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing that literally 5 seconds after the thing shit the bed. One thing I wanted to add before we move on to the questions we had, I just wanted to bring up. I remember that night, that first pay-per-view, RVD, Rob Van Dam, wrestled the first match against Lance Storm, and I remember the whole big thing. It was like he was an added thing at the end or a reserve that had come in to fill in, and he cut this promo. Did you remember kind of meeting him, or had you known him already that night, and what that was about when he cut a promo in the ring about how he was better than a backup or something of that nature? I vaguely remember that happening, but do you remember meeting him that night, or had you known him already going into that night?
I probably met him that night or before that, and I would, you know what, if somebody handed me a microphone, especially over the past few years, and said, tell us what you think, I would definitely tell people, you know, I'm not a backup, I'm not a last resort, I'm not this or that. So for Rob to say that, he's a strong-minded individual, and Rob isn't a backup, so there you go. He's right.
Pretty much, yeah. Go ahead.
I was just kind of going off the Barely Legal thing. Obviously, we've all seen in the Beyond the Mat documentary, Paul's big speech backstage to get everyone fired up for that pay-per-view. Let's just talk just for a moment about Paul Heyman, your interactions with him, your experiences with him. You know, obviously, he's well-renowned as one of the best creative minds in wrestling. You know, where did you always stand with him? Was he someone you really enjoyed working for? I mean, obviously, you were there quite a while, so I'm sure you did get along well with him. But what's your experiences with Paul?
Well, you know, from a creative standpoint, Paul could, you know, the best way to describe Paul Heyman without going into too much detail is he is the best motivator, better than any college pro football coach, which football's on right now with the first Monday night game. So it kind of reminded me of that when I was watching Rex Ryan talk, you know, and Paul Heyman is like that. Paul Heyman is a guy that can motivate you. Paul Heyman is a guy that can bring out the best in you. Call as a guy when he's in production can hide your weaknesses, which back then I had a lot. I was not the worker, anywhere near the worker that I am today. So those were his strong points, and those are simple. Accentuate the strengths, hide the weaknesses, he said in a million interviews, and also motivate your talent to make them want to do, you know, like I think people had said it before, we would just go into war for Paul, because he motivated us to bring out the best in us every night. So I would say he's a, you know, not so much a creative genius, because I think a bigger compliment is he's a motivator.
Do you think, you know, he's someone that could be obviously utilized in one of the major promotions today? Do you feel like his time, you know, really has come and you know, maybe he's better suited for what he's doing now, helping obviously bringing a lot of publicity to Brock Lesnar and MMA, but, you know, do you think it was a mistake for TNA not to bring him in when they had the chance a couple years ago and give him full control? Do you think that's something he still has the energy and ability to pull off?
It's really hard to say. You know, this is I don't know if anybody told you, but this is a fake subjective business.
Mm-hmm.
And
true.
You know, a lot of times, not just in the ring, but outside the ring, it just always comes down to someone's opinion. If someone had a high enough opinion, which I do have a really good mind for this business, because people like Paul, Tommy, Raven, and everybody in WWE who I pick brains over the years as far as their creative and workflows and what they do. You know, if someone entrusted me to write a TV show, I could write a good TV show if I was allowed to write a good TV show. Then, you know, it's just all sorts of different like things that come into play. If Paul had complete control over something, that'd be great. If Vince Russo had complete control over something, which I'm not sure if he does or he doesn't, maybe it would be different in TNA.
Right.
In WWE right now, I think Triple H kind of has complete final say on stuff. And I think that's the difference between WWE and TNA. Vince always had final say, and maybe Triple H has final say now. When someone has that final word, you know it's not going to be chaotic throughout the day. You go check with Hunter, you go check with Vince. If they say no, guess what? No.
Right.
That's
right.
It. And TNA, I don't think works that way.
Okay, definitely an interesting take, and that's what I was hoping to get, because, you know, usually you get you know, a lot of people thinking Paul Heyman could be the savior, but it all comes down to, like you said, the overall structure of the company and what kind of...
Yeah, if he's put in the position to save the company, I'm sure he could. I'm sure you could if you were put in a position and had the support and had the allowance to do it. Mm-hmm. Anybody, I think a lot of people could. Wrestling shows are not that hard to write. I'm sorry. It's basic good and evil. It's basically a slow burn. And the number one thing that I think TNA needs to do, and I've said this right to Dixie Carter, and I said this when Terry was there, when Russo was there, or when I was there with them, I said, who are we competing against? If we're competing against WWE, then you're crazy. Just push your guys very slow, build your characters, do six-month programs with payoffs on pay-per-view. That's why they're called payoffs. People pay to see the end of the story. You don't give it away for free. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes perfect sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Very, very,
yep.
Yeah, very clear. It makes a lot of sense, like you said. And a lot of it is basic, and it seems like, you know, a lot of promotions just overthink what they need to do to really draw and make money. Just present a realistic product, you know, wrestling matches that people want to see, and like you said, build to something. And WWE can do it when they want to do it. They just seem not to always choose to, which is a whole nother podcast on its own. So
yes, that's true.
So let's jump back in time now, back again to 97. Of course, you had the major neck injury. You would leave ECW and eventually head over to WCW. Yeah, I know there's a little bit of controversy between that, just from your story on the ECW DVD and you know, stories that go around. Tell us a little bit in your words about that time, your neck injury and then ending up with WCW.
Well, the story on the DVDs, they didn't edit anything out. That's the story. Pretty much it was just, you know, a rash of bad decisions and being a young guy and being influenced by certain people and not thinking for myself. And, you know, everybody makes mistakes. Maybe it pretty much stalled my career, or maybe it ruined my career and put me into that downward spiral of just being, you know, mid-carder at best. In WWE, maybe I never, but I think I worked my way back and proved myself over the years with my body of work that, you know, I pretty much, you know, it's hard to explain. I guess I went from being somebody in a spot that was very young. I matured as I went along and kind of, like I said before, kind of learned some things the hard way and then came out a better worker and a better person for it. You know, if I went through all that stuff, if I just got handed everything throughout the business, like some people do, I might've turned out to be a real jack off.
Now you go to WCW, which obviously at the time was at the peak of the Monday Night Wars. They were at number one, at least on paper in the ratings. What was it like going from one locker room to the other? Was there a shock to the system for you as a performer going from Philly to Atlanta, I guess is in the old promotion words. You got hooked back up with Raven again. And then obviously leaving. What was going on in that time when you were there? Was it in terms of dealing with that promotion and working with Raven again? What was some of that like?
It was fine. I mean, everybody was making money in WCW. Everybody was making a lot of money, and the schedules were easier, and everybody was happy when I was there. I left before all the other crazy stuff happened. I do remember that shows weren't written until right before airtime. Shows weren't done. And my match had changed with Randy Savage, God bless his soul, for the whole day up until his music. Stuff like that happened all the time. Of course,
wow.
I was used to that from ECW because that's what we did in ECW.
right in your wheelhouse then.
Yeah, stuff changed just like that. The stuff with William Raven, like I said, it just was a continuation of us having our own issues, him having his demons and it affecting his personality and not getting along. That's pretty much what it was. And me going to make yet another decision. And, you know, I went from a person that quit things too easily to a fault to, some would say these days, especially with my WWE run, staying too long and not giving up, you know, to a fault, that, you know, staying there too long and not quitting and going to another company when I saw that it wasn't taking me anywhere.
I've actually been watching those episodes of Nitro over the last couple of weeks, right from that time period where you and Raven were in the crowd, and I actually didn't remember how they really did put some depth to that. You know, in my memory, I just remembered you guys showing up, you had the brief run, you wrestled Raven, and then you left. But watching it, I didn't realize that they actually kind of brought that depth of the Raven character from ECW out during that time. So it was a nice little memory boost to see, you know, that they did do week to week. They slowly developed him through promos, and then every week they had a new member of the flock in the crowd with you guys. I think I'm up to Kidman joining now. So it's cool to kind of go back and relive, you know, those days of WCW. And everyone craps on their memory and says they did a lot wrong, but they also did a lot right for a few years. And they did put out a lot of memorable shows that had a very distinct feel from what WWF was doing.
Well, the thing that made Nitro a success was what should make every wrestling show a success: a variety show. Different characters, different kinds of wrestling, different things for everybody. If you don't like one thing, how about these other seven or eight types of things over the next 2 hours? And that's something I think that, you know, there's no characters anymore. There's no really standout, unique. The people don't, you know, with all these rules and these dress codes and all these other things, people don't let the wrestlers be themselves. Mm-hmm. If you notice, so, you know, I was handed scripts many, many times and then told I couldn't cut a promo. And I said, I don't want to cut a promo. I want to talk.
Right.
Let me be myself. In the ECW, I was just allowed to be an extension of what I really was. Let me be who I am and you'll make money. And that's what I think is the problem with both companies right now. They're too script centric, if that's a word.
And the problem here is that these guys coming up this way can't adapt. You know, at least guys in your generation, when they were forced to be put in that position, you know, you could think on your feet, you had the background and the ability. A lot of the guys they're bringing up now come through their system where that's all they know is the script and just, you know, go by the book. And that, unfortunately, they're not prepared when it comes to a time where they have to hang or improvise or change things on the spot. They can't do it. So, that's definitely, you know, points the future of the business in a rocky direction, I think.
I just need to hire me as a trainer. Everything will be fixed instantly.
I agree.
Absolutely.
You're not going to get any arguments from us.
Yes.
That's happen.
So you leave WCW. You head back to Philly, to ECW. You had mentioned that you left ECW on, you know, a little shaky ground. What was it like heading back? Was there any kind of tension in the back? Were you welcomed back easily? What were things like when you headed back to ECW?
And it was pretty tense, and rightfully so. I walked out on the company. There was a lot of stuff going on between Paul Heyman and myself with the money and the way he did business like that. And, you know, that's neither here nor there. That's done. But, you know, the guys didn't know that, and they just saw somebody that they invested. I learned a lesson there of guys, you know, that are having time invested. When you have a spot like I had, you know, it doesn't come easily. It kind of came easily for me back then because I didn't understand, because I didn't be on TV for, I wasn't on TV for another company and struggling to even just get a spot or get booked. It just was, I was always used and I was on TV and I was always in a good spot. So when I walked out on that, I can see why guys said, you know, walked out on a really good opportunity to, you know, and the company invested money and time into you, and they had a right to be upset. So when I came back for the match with Chetty, I already had a broken neck, or like had herniated disc in my neck, and I had a bone crack or whatever, but the herniated disc was really bad. And I got that back when my first stint in ECW in May of 97, when Sandman hit me with a kick. No, that was January. God, there were so many times I hurt my neck. And that, he hit me in Middletown, New York months before that and hurt my neck, but that was just a stinger. Terry Funk, when he dropped the guardrail on my neck, which is on DVD as well, that really messed my neck up for a long time. And it had some mental and emotional effects on me too, because I had never been injured like that before. So I wasn't exactly sure what in the world was going on. So I guess I just went to WCW to try to make some money. And I think I was more stupid actually for leaving WCW, because they were going to pay for my surgery. They were going to do all this stuff, pay me a really good salary just to be under contract. And I probably could have made some good money, but at the same time wouldn't have the work ethic I have now, because like I said, it would have came so easily to me. I probably would have been lazy.
A lot of guys definitely did take advantage of WCW during that time with the guaranteed money, that's for sure.
Yeah, if they came back now, I'd take advantage of it. I'd sit in that crowd was the easiest money I ever made.
Well, look at Sting. How much was he making for a year of sitting up at the rafters and coming down for 3 minutes and beating everyone up?
Yeah, but Sting was on the road with NWA and busting his ass.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
This, and he paid his dues. Let him go play with that frigging crow for 2 years.
It definitely might have been the best deal, I think, yeah, any wrestler ever had.
Yeah. What are your overall impressions of the money of what is termed the Monday Night Wars? We obviously know who won, but you were you saw a couple of sides of it. The side that was winning at the time, and that Maverick third party that kind of might have thrown a monkey wrench into the whole mix. What were your impressions on that era in the mid '90s in general for the business?
Well, I thought it was exciting. It was great. It was gay. Even the wrestlers were fans and watched both shows. Like when we got done, even with when I was in WWE, they would replay Nitro. And after we would be done with Raw, we would go back to the hotel. Or if we were staying in town that night, we would watch the replay and see what they did. It was very exciting. It reminded me a lot of, you know, when you're on a sports team, you're watching other sports teams that you're going to be playing. It really, I think it really hurt the business when Vince bought WCW, which, you know, I mean, he just bought the library. He didn't buy the company, but to not have that second promotion with major TV and that money backer and Ted Turner and AOL Ted Turner at the time, you know, it just, it just hurt the business, you know, when there's no competition. And you see it now, guys are, you know, I know I've been in both companies where guys are barely paying their bills or making anything, but people think they're on TV and they're making $1 million. Well, that's not true, especially in TNA. You know, and the Jeff Neal thing tells that story because that's true.
Now, while the competition and the multiple promotions was actually, you know, obviously great for wrestlers, do you think, you know, the business itself suffered by having that Monday Night Wars long term? Because, you know, the focus became on ratings, beating your competition, putting, you know, big time matches on TV constantly. Do you think that took away from a formula that had been working for many years where, like you said, you build to something to have people pay for? And not focus as much on those TV ratings, which seems to become, you know, something that still lingers on today, even though there's no legit competition for Vince McMahon. It seems like they still harp a lot on the TV ratings and, you know, they do a lot on TV that they should be saving for pay-per-view. Do you think that was a long-term bad side effect from the Attitude Era?
Yeah, I don't understand these days. I mean, back then, it seemed like they were building stuff even better with the Monday Night Wars. When you figure that, well, we need to hotshot everything we can get our hands on. They did a better job of slow burning everything they do now. And I don't understand, because there's nobody should be competing with another company, because, you know, TNA and WWE are on two different levels, and just pay attention to what you're doing, or actually pay attention to what the other guy's doing and then do the exact opposite. And that was TNA's, success early on, the X Division, the six-sided ring, all this other stuff that made them different. So, and I don't know. Back then, it didn't seem like hotshotting, because one company had 130 wrestlers that were names under contract. You could interchange them all and had 10 hours of TV, and it didn't seem stale. And WWE was just doing something completely on own. It was ECW. It was the Attitude Era. And, you know, they were coming back into their own and making characters, and Vince was forced. I believe Vince works best, and I don't know Vince that well personally, but what I've seen is when Vince gets a bug up his ass and when Vince is motivated to destroy somebody, he works his best.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's definitely been his track record, whether it be in the 80s, you know, ripping through all the different territories to build his promotion, and then again, obviously, in the late 90s, you know, to take out WCW. So now, of course, speaking of Vince, you signed with the WWF in the summer of 99, and they immediately put you back with your buddy, the Blue Meanie. Was that their intent coming in? Was that something he suggested or you suggested? How did that all come about?
I think that was Russo. Russo was writing at the time. So, yeah, I think that was Russo that did that. So put us together, and then Vince saw some entertainment in me with the, you know, imitating people and doing stuff like that. I don't know. Like I said, it was kind of like ECW, where I just kind of showed up and did whatever they told me to do and never figured out what the origin of it was. I just wanted to work and make some money.
Did you like going back to the imitation stuff, or did you feel by that point you were kind of ready for something else?
I had to pay my dues all over again. So I realized that, and I didn't have any, problems with it.
Mm-hmm. What was it like, you know, here is Vince McMahon, this larger than life figure. Throughout your life as a kid, you and your brother watching wrestling, and then, of course, you in ECW and then to WCW. Now here you are. You're in the promotion, and you are in Vince's domain. you said you don't know him that well, but I'm assuming you obviously met him, got to know him, I would think. What was it like working under him? Was the structure different compared to WCW and ECW? What was it like as a promotion, the day-to-day workings compared to ECW or WCW?
Well, if you're talking about appearances and going on PR stuff and doing stuff like that, all the outside the ring stuff and the way the business runs, it's first class all the way. It's a first class. It's very organized. It's run very well. It has to be. I mean, he's running. Vince is a very huge perfectionist with himself and with everybody around him. As far as personally dealing with him, I've talked to him. I've trained Shane for his match with Shawn Michaels when he wrestled Shawn Michaels back. I think it was Saturday night's main event. Mm-hmm. And I dealt with Vince over that. And Vince knows I work hard. I never really politicked or kissed his ass a whole lot, but I worked hard. And that's what I think, in my opinion, he appreciated to some degree that, hey, this guy just wants to work hard for me and that's it. And I always believed, or whoever I worked for, I didn't want to go up and tell them, hey, I'm going to have a good match tonight. I'm going to work hard. And when I go home, I'm going to work out and I'm going to be in shape and I'm going to be tan and I'm not going to be on drugs and I'm not going to be drunk. And well, if you see me and you watch my match, then you know I did all those things. Mm-hmm. I'll have to tell you. So I think he hopefully knew that.
I think deep down, Vince, to me, always comes across when you hear those kind of stories about him. Yeah, I think as much as he tries to get away and says, oh, this isn't wrestling, this is movies and all this other stuff, I think deep down he's still a wrestling fan at heart, like old school wrestling. And like you said, I think he always appreciates guys like you. Obviously, you know, he had you around for a while in that role. So I think he always appreciates those guys that work hard and put a lot of effort into the craft. So I could definitely see what you're saying.
Now, here you are in the middle of the boom. I mean, this is the boom, and you were in ECW. WWE was kind of down, WCW was kind of in the middle, and then of course NWO started, and now here you are, you've gone through all the promotions over this 2-year stretch. Do you ever like actually take a minute when you're on the, whether you're on the road or maybe in the back, or kind of collecting your thoughts going, wow, I'm in the middle of like maybe the biggest boom of this industry ever? I mean, do you ever actually sit and kind of think that, like, wow, here I am in the middle of probably the greatest rise of this industry ever? Do you ever actually kind of sit back and take it all in?
No. I'm a very big proponent on it. I think that's what's kept me, maybe, you know, what some people would say, I don't look like I've been in the business well over 20 years. I don't look like I'm almost 40 years old. I look like I'm, you know, can still go, which I can. I don't look back. I'm not nostalgic. I'm not like an old man on the porch looking back at my career. I don't believe in ever really stopping and trying to be content. You know, I'm not a very content person. I'm a very intense person. And I always believe every day, you know, that you need to learn something, you need to advance yourself in some way, no matter what it is. And I feel like if I keep looking back and watching my matches like a mark, that I'm going to keep living in the past, like that high school kid who said, oh, I could have made state championships, but I blew my knee out, that kind of person. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense? I know it's cool. I know it was cool. And I know I've been everywhere, but it's me. I'm Michael Mannin. I'm still that skinny kid from Port Richmond in Philadelphia. I'm still the guy you see. If I was still in Connecticut, you would see me at the GameStop at Meriden Mall over there. And, you know, and that's all I am. I don't think I'm Stevie Richards. I'm not a mark for myself, and I'm really not a mark for the business. I don't mean that in a negative way.
No, you know, it's,
hang on. We all know what happens when that siren hits, Stevie.
I forget what happens.
Right, the sensor comes out.
And a migraine. Well, that's when a big fat 262-pound guy with a shaved head comes out with. People don't want to be in the gimmick.
Well, that's what we want to talk about next. But Scott, God, I'm sorry if I cut you off. Did you have?
No, I was just going to say, I think that's awesome because I've been in that Meriden GameStop. So, and I bought a couple games myself at that mall. So up there. So that's actually that's very cool. I'm a mark for GameStop. So I'm glad you brought up that particular story. That's pretty funny. But now I've been cut off because, you know, the siren came on. So go ahead, Justin.
All right. So obviously, Stevie, coming off the Imitation stuff, it seems like you bounced around a little bit early that year, and then they hooked you up with the Right to Censor. What did you think of that idea when they presented it to you?
It wasn't supposed to be a long-term thing, but for some reason, I guess I got it over to Vince with what I was doing, and he saw that I could be a really tried and true 100% heel. Nothing cool about me, nothing. And that's something I learned from Raven. I didn't do anything cool. I didn't do anything that people would like. Even the music was annoying. No, I don't even like the music. So,
who does?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it just, it was good. It was very good. You know, I think I was wish when I do look back, which I don't often do, but I wish that I was in better shape for that kind of gimmick and could wrestle a little bit better than I did. I wasn't in the best shape I could be. That was my heaviest, 262 pounds. That was the heaviest I've ever been.
Actually, I remember I was in Worcester that night when you came out, and I think it was Terry was stripping or something, and you covered her up, and that was the start of the whole thing.
Yeah.
So what was it like teaming up with the different members of the group? Any particular ones you liked more? Do you think as a unit there was everyone worked well together? It was, of course, the Good Father and Bull Buchanan and Ivory. And then Val Venus eventually. What were your thoughts of the different members? Anyone that you would have liked to see in the group with you, or anyone that you thought maybe didn't really fit?
No, I think it could have went anywhere. As far as Vince, he could have put anybody in there. He could have put The Rock in there, put Austin in there. I mean, it could have went as far as they wanted it to go, or, you know, we could have just kept it with me. They decided to put a bunch of people with me. And I think we all worked well together. I think the Ivory factor made it even better with all the girls. That's the one that, without a girl in the group, it really would have just been, you know, just a bunch of guys just, you know, complaining about everything. But when a girl's there and complaining about the Divas, which makes them even kind of hotter to the general public, that's what it is. When you have something like that where we're so not cool, it makes everybody else look even cooler. And it makes people, hopefully the fans, appreciate the hardcore stuff. And you can cut it back a little bit and protect the talent. And I'm sure that's what Vince was thinking, too.
I always thought that the switch from the Godfather to the Good Father was one of the smartest, most creative name changes of all time. I thought that was just really funny when they did that.
I had to do it anyway for advertisers and all that stuff. It was no choice. So Vince turned a negative into a positive, as he usually does.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, the gimmick pretty much ran into the next year, and of course culminated with WrestleMania X7, which is also, in my eyes, kind of the peak of that whole era. Do you think that the gimmick had run its course when it ended, or do you think they ended it a little prematurely?
They ended it prematurely because Jamie Mars, the guy who wrote for the, you know, Right to Censor material, we wrote it together, me and him. So a lot of the stuff came from both of us. You know, he left the company and he was on kind of bad terms, I think, with Brian Gerwartz, who's still there. And Brian, I don't think, was ever a fan of the gimmick, nor a fan of me, even though I am a fan of comic books.
Yeah, which, you fit right in.
Yeah. So, you know, he wasn't a fan of me, and that's fine. It's his opinion. But, you know, that is when it ended. And it ended pretty abruptly, if you think about it.
Well, it definitely did. It's like you lost that big match at WrestleMania, and then I think Undertaker just kind of wiped you all out, and that was that.
Yeah, I don't remember it, but that's fine. And I don't ever did drugs and I don't drink or anything. I just don't remember it.
Well, you've definitely been through quite a bit and you've experienced a lot.
My faculty, I get tested. My faculties are pretty quiet. You go to t4show.com. I'm a genius.
Well, I just meant experience-wise. You've seen a lot and experienced a lot, so it's not a surprise that there's some stuff.
I think I just want to forget about that fat fuck that was... I don't want to think about that person again.
Okay, I'm sorry I brought it up.
So obviously, right after that happened, the RTC came to an end. The invasion started. Obviously, we mentioned earlier that Vince bought the library of WCW because obviously, as a promotion, WCW no longer existed. Your other former employer, ECW, ended in that. I think it was that February. I think it was the last pay per view. I think it was that last pay per view, that February. Then everybody kind of got together, and then that whole summer you had the WWF and the Alliance, which was the combination of WCW and ECW. You were right in the middle of it. What was your thoughts on how that was put together and what you thought of the way it laid out?
I'm sure you've interviewed other people like Raven and other people who have their take on it. Mine's pretty much the same. They pretty much took a big boatload of cash and strapped dynamite to it and blew it up and didn't want the money they could have made with, I mean, Vince could have kept WCW separate for a couple of years and had an inter-brand pay-per-view. He could have done a whole bunch of stuff culminating at WrestleMania, and he could have just, the general fan, if Vince never did that last Nitro the way he did and he had a TV deal in place, he could have kept WCW separate to the casual fan for a year and a half, and it'd be like Pepsi and Coke with all their side products. You would never know that Pepsi and Coke own all these other drinks on the side, and it's the same company. So that's, I think, a point where Vince just wanted to prove that he won. It didn't matter how much money. He just wanted to prove that WWE was better.
And it's too bad, because like you said, I mean, there was a lot of money to be made if they didn't rush through everything the way they did, especially with the whole ECW stuff. I mean, that was a great moment in Raw when the ECW guys all turned around and showed that they reunited. And then by the end of the show, they're with WCW, and it's Stephanie comes out, and it's all kind of, you know, let the air out of the balloon. And, you know, to show you how much it would have worked, that Invasion pay-per-view, I remember, they did really well with that. They did big numbers, and it showed you that the audience would be there for something like that. But as you said, they just weren't interested in making it work. Vince was just interested in saying he won, and that was that, so...
It's unfortunate, but all that talent and obviously all those, you know, those weighed down contracts he didn't want to touch, you know, the Nashes, the Goldbergs and all those. It was all the other talent. And I agree. You know, a lot of people said that when they had that match with, what was it, Booker T and Buff Bagwell on Nitro, and then they beat up Buff Bagwell and threw him out the back door, that pretty much it was a symbol of that's how things were going to go. And it is unfortunate. It is like I actually like your analogy, Stevie, about strapping dynamite to money and blowing it up. Now, after that, as the year progressed, you ended up hooking up with Chronic. As Undertaker and Kane were about to beat you up, Chronic, Brian Adams, Brian Clark came in and backed you up, and you kind of managed them. What was it like working with them?
They were only in for like a week or two. So they were decent guys. They were fine. That was about it. They had a really horrible match against Undertaker and Kane at Unforgiven, I think. And it was a shame because they had a great look. I liked them in WCW. They were kind of like a tag team version of Goldberg, if you think about it. I mean, especially Brian Clark. Brian Adams was great. He was a huge guy. He's been there at WWE and WCW for a bunch of times. But, you know, Brian Clark had a great look as Wrath, and WCW had sort of the Goldberg look to him. And, you know, they could have brought him back even as single, both of them as singles wrestlers in different gimmicks. You can always make money with everybody. I always think that you can always get the most out of everybody. That's what Paul did back in ECW. And that's sort of what I don't think many companies do. They haven't done it for a very long time. And it's a shame. One match and out, I dyed my hair black permanently. And that was another thing. What am I going to do? I'd take a chance, you know. It could be one match, or it could have lasted a year and a half, like the Right to Censor.
And I think Chronic could have worked. I put that question in there because I really liked Chronic in WCW, and I was probably like one of the 10 people that was excited when they signed, and that match happened. And I thought they had a great look, and like you said, they definitely were two guys that could have been more than what they were given. And I remember really liking Wrath in WCW. I felt like he was always underused. I liked that whole little thing that had going on with Glacier and Mortis, and it was something different. You know, and like you said before, WCW was a mixed bag for everyone. It had a lot of cool different things. They had these serious storylines, and they had the Cruiserweights, and then they had the kind of goofy under subworld going on with those three guys fighting nonstop for like 2 years. But
I like the way you put that, subworld.
It was like underground battle. They had these three guys were like warring for like all these years. But
the lights went out, the fake snow falling. Hey, he was good as Adam Bomb too.
Yes, he was.
It's funny. So you documented your thoughts on Invasion, the storyline. So you're the booker. You're Vince. Okay, you get this cachet of guys handed at you, or this whole scenario. How do you think you would have done it differently if you were in charge of that summer of 2001? How would you have done it?
Now, what I would have done is keep WCW and ECW on separate TV networks, hopefully keeping some kind of deal in place with somebody. I know that TBS and TNT wouldn't be the way to go, but, you know, ECW could have got local syndication. I mean, Vince is a pretty, you know, he's a pretty big player in the entertainment industry. I'm sure he could have put a deal together very quickly, or at least kept TBS and TNT putting Nitro on there for a little while longer as part of the deal of buying the library. You know, give me 2 months and I'll get another TV network to pick it up. Then I would just keep everybody separate. And you know what? Right now they're doing it, they tried to do an ECW anyway. I would have made ECW the farm league. I would have put the young guys there, newly signed talent. And once in a while, just have somebody jump somebody from WWE and do the invasion angle, the NWA angle all over again in the beginning when Nash and Hall just showed up on Nitro and everybody thought they were with the WWE. Why not have a WCW guy do that or a WCW guy go to East? Do you see how it can all just, but you're convincing the casual fan that, hey, they're three separate companies, but mm-hmm. Vince is getting all the money from all three and also feeding his company for the next 10 or 20 years with talent from each company of the younger guys that you sign and you throw them there that aren't ready for the WWE spotlight, as he would put it.
And it seemed like he'd have that idea a few years later, and we'll get to that in a moment. But obviously, coming off the invasion and the alliance from there, you kind of moved over to Heat as being your main show for a while, and you started the whole Stevie Knight Heat gimmick. And to me, that was kind of the prototype for like what Zack Ryder does nowadays, where he basically went out a guy maybe wasn't really getting the push he deserved, the TV time he deserved, and kind of made it happen for himself and got himself over. And you did that with the Stevie Knight Heat stuff, really gaining a following amongst fans watching that show and waiting, you know, every week to see where you're going with it. Was that something you came up with? Were you working with a writer on that? Were you kind of under the radar with it for a while? Because it definitely seemed that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Coach Allen, I came up with Stevie Knight Heat. I came up with, you know, all the stuff. I made the tights. I actually made a belt just like Zack Ryder. I had the Heat championship that I was going to defend on Heat and lose it my first match to Spike Dudley. And Mike didn't care about having a belt, but he knew what it meant to me, so he was going to defend it every week. You see, the thing back then, and nobody knew for 7 months. We walked in, Stephanie McMahon walked in as we were taping a pre-tape because Coach Al Snow and I all put the pre-tapes together, and for some reason, because nobody watched Heat, we could get it on air. I swear to God, they never watched Heat because we were doing it for 6 or 7 months, putting pre-tapes up, doing all this stuff. The commentators were there. They just didn't care about the show. So, you know, I was standing there. Coach and Al Snow had gone to Raw. This is when they were fighting Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler, yep, which was god-awful. But anyway, we were trying to keep them on Heat. And we didn't have any money because obviously on Heat, we don't have the big sponsors that Raw does. So we made them chocolate pies. And I had a chef hat on and I had an apron that said kiss the GM. Victoria forgot. We didn't make them. We got them from a supermarket, but Victoria forgot to take them out of the plastic and actually ate some of the chocolate pie. So she had some of that over her face. She had chocolate pie all over her face. So now Stephanie McMahon and Johnny Ace walk in, and John Laurinaitis, and walk in and see this scene playing out. And Stephanie asked Johnny, who knew about Stevie Knight Heat, Johnny, what the hell is this? And he was like, I have no idea, Stephanie. It's not me. I don't know. It's all Stevie's idea. And I was just like, well, yeah, it is. That's my idea. And then, that's when I went off TV for a while. If they don't want you to get over, they're not going to get Zach is very lucky right now. Mm-hmm. But if they wanted to shut him off or shut him down, like they have been for many, many months, even a year, some would say over a year, they'll do it. It's a fake subjective business. The injuries are real. The travel's real. Everything's real. But I'm not saying that. I'm just saying they determine how much you make. They determine how much you're on TV. They determine everything about your career. It's not up to you.
It's just like that stuff is so deflating to hear when a guy like you or even a guy like Zack Ryder is working your ass off to just, you know, really get yourself over and make something out of nothing. And
that's not going to make me work any less hard.
Right, right.
I want them. Now my number one thing was obviously to not leave anything to chance that it could be my fault. Mm-hmm. That I'm not getting used. But deep down in a way, sometimes I would say, you know what? I'm going to work as hard. I'm going to look great. I'm going to have great matches just to make them look fucking stupid.
Yep. And you definitely did. I mean, and there's no doubt when that, and I'm glad you confirmed all these stories that were always circulating that, you know, this whole thing was under the radar. They didn't know about it. And then to find out, you know, this C-level show that they were barely paying attention to, you were making important to fans. You know, fans enjoyed watching it. Yep. And then they take it away from the fans for no reason. It's just like,
We were drawing impact ratings.
Yeah.
What Impact is getting now, I was drawing 1.0, 1.1 when I was doing the angle with Goldust. And we had angles that lasted 3, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, longer than some of the stuff that leads up to pay-per-views. And it was fun.
I mean, there was a time where those shows were better than the major shows. I mean, Velocity at that point, had a lot of the cruiserweight stuff on it, and they had their own little angles going, and then Heat had the stuff with you on it, and it was like, those are almost the the can't miss shows of the week a lot of times in 2003, 2004.
Yeah, but the company, this is the thing too. I hear these things, or I've used to read the internet where people, and let's call them marks, would say, Steve Richards is a jobber, he's nobody, he's this and that. But you know what? If WWE decide to have me run out there and jump The Rock or John Cena or CM Punk or any of the top guys, or even just be, come up and punch Vince in the face on Raw, guess what? I'm a top guy. Mm-hmm. I'm the same guy I was before. I'm actually a better worker than I was back in the BWO. If you want me to be honest, back then when I was supposed to be main eventer, it was somebody deciding we're going to make him a main eventer.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So also during this period, you mentioned her performance, Victoria. A very unique pairing around this time, obviously, having the female wrestler and the male kind of manager, valet. And I thought it worked. I thought it was something different. And you guys obviously seemed like you had a lot of chemistry together during that period. Is that true? Did you have to work hard or did it come easy with her? She always seemed a great talent.
She's an easy person to get along with. She's funny. The thing was that just like in ECW, nobody in WWE was willing to be emasculated and be some woman's bitch. Mm-hmm. I saw that as well. Nobody wants to do it. Guess what I'm going to do? Because nobody's going to steal my gimmick.
Yep.
I'll stand out. It's and the funny part is about the business is some of the biggest marks are actually in the office. And if you lose a match, they think you're a loser. You're like, it's a football game or something. It's so weird. Yeah, they can control it and make you a star. But then when you do something, they think you're that person. The line between what's fake and real is blurred so much. It's almost makes your head spin.
And you can definitely say that the pairing worked and it did stand out, because that is something, I think you remember all these years later, was during Victoria's run with the Divas title, was you by her side. And, I did think it worked well then. And it's good that you had that perspective. I think that definitely says a lot about, like you said, your work ethic and your desire to make something work and get over, that you will do whatever it takes and work your ass off to make it count. And you always did that. I can say that about you.
I think that's why you're a favorite of more people than, like you said, a normal wrestling fan would think, because you did, there are a lot of times you were the entertaining part of the show. You were another Rock promo. He said the same thing last week. And, oh, wow, here comes, Stevie. And, wow, this is kind of funny. And you're like, wow. And I think that's you were the kind of character and wrestler that a lot of the fans kind of jumped onto, because you were kind of bringing the funny part of the, wow, that was actually pretty funny. A funny skit or a funny segment, and the parts of Victoria and the was good for the shows, because that's, you need a little levity amongst all the serious main event stuff, you should be very proud of it. And as fans, as two fans here, we applaud you for it, because it was pretty it was a good time to kind of have that little extra part that was funny while everything else was so serious and everybody wanted to be at the top of the food chain, and not self-deprecation didn't seem to be too common in the business a lot of times. And you got to have those kind of guys who kind of make fun of themselves and make the shows funnier. Do you see that more now? Kind of mocking themselves for the sake of television in a lot of in the business?
Not really. What's funny is I always use this analogy, is that you are miserable at your job. You hate working all day long and you're so stressed out. And then you watch wrestling and somebody is pissing and moaning about this or that, and they're mad, they're not going to take it anymore, and they're angry, and there's all these negative, stressful emotions that you're trying to escape, and they don't look like they're having fun out there in the ring. And do you ever notice that? Sometimes you're like, wow, this show's not very fun. Mm-hmm. Or you can have an intense match and wrestle and still be a character and want to kick somebody's ass. I mean, UFC is fun to watch, and those guys are beating the hell out of each other, but it doesn't look like it's such a chore for them to be in the octagon and fighting one another. It looks like they really love what they're doing, right?
Yes.
And a lot of times in wrestling, it doesn't convey the same way, because they're trying to overplay this, you fucked my mother, I'll fuck your father, or do this. You're at my cat over with a plane, or some bullshit, storyline or whatever. With me,
spilled my coffee.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You spilled my coffee, so now I'm gonna, you know, I can't get over it because
stole
I'm,
my shampoo commercial.
Exactly. I'm a billionaire that can't get over the fact that you spilled a piece of, you know, a couple $2,000 suit. But yeah, I mean, that's something I strove for with that, and I wish that they would make it a lot more fun. Zack Ryder's a great addition to the show. I hope they haven't pigeonholed him too much into being, well, I hate this term, comedy act, because you're telling the guy what to do.
Yep.
You know, yep. He's not a comedy act. He's a guy who's having a good time. If you want to look at it, hey, isn't The Rock a comedy act?
Yes.
Comes out with 20 lines and says the same thing all the time. Hey, that people's elbow, when Vince could have saw that thing and said, oh my God, send this guy back down to Memphis or Florida. He sucks. That elbow didn't even touch that guy.
Same with the worm.
The worm, that's our stuff. Santino with the cobra, which is very. Santino gets a reaction like a top guy.
Yes, and he hasn't even been on. It's only like the punishing him for doing what they told him to do.
What I heard is that Santino, Brian Gerwich likes Santino because it reminds him of somebody he knows back in his neighborhood or something, and that's basically he's entertained by it. And Santino does that person.
That's pretty funny.
We forgot one of the best reasons to fight someone. You had sex with my dead girlfriend in a casket. That was another good one.
Yes.
And I don't think it was that bad. I feel bad for Glenn, but I'd rather fuck a girl in a casket than wear a dress for 6 months.
That's also true.
Oh God. We'll probably get back to that anyway.
Not going to do that. Pretty much summed it up.
2005, Vince decides to do a one night only reunion of the real, of the old school ECW. ECW one night stand, June, remember the date? I think it was the 12th. June 12th, it was near my brother's birthday, 2005, at the old Hammerstein. And Justin and I, we both reviewed that on our message board, and it's probably one of our favorite shows of all time. And then, of course, they did it again a year later, 2006. Mm-hmm. What did you think about that when you first heard the rumblings that they were going to do this one night only reunion show and Paul was going to be involved? And what were your thoughts about that when that was first getting talked about?
Well, I think this is during the time that I was training with Shane McMahon for his match against Shawn Michaels. And they were talking about how, you know, I was going to be an agent. Lance Storm was going to be an agent. Tommy was going to run the whole thing. Because Tommy lived in the area and he came to the office a lot because he was in the office. So we would sit down and talk about it. And they even talked about teaming me and Johnny Swinger up, who I think is a great talent. He still looks great to this day and still can work. And they were going to team us together because we had a certain look. There's a whole bunch of things that went around that never, ever happened. And then, you know, the one night stand, the first one was just amazing, you know, and could have been a launch pad for something really special again, but we kind of knew it wasn't going to happen that way.
The crowd was obviously off the charts. Then there was the great, battle in the, at the end. And I'll tell you something, I give a lot of credit, and I've written this in the review. I gave a lot of credit to, to Bischoff and to JBL, cause he was a prick, but at least on camera. But because they could have gotten killed standing in the balcony there at Hammerstein. But the heat that night was great. As a fan, it was amazing. And Taz coming down with his old school music, and obviously the big thing that came out that night was, of course, you reuniting with Meanie and Nova and bringing back the Blue World Order. How did that feel, getting that back together for that night?
It felt good. I would rather have had a full match, but I needed knee surgery right after that pay-per-view. So if you look closely, you'll see my left knee is taped up underneath the knee pad. So another unfortunate match with Chris Masters.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
The sludge to the face.
Yeah, I really think there was a point where they were trying to kill me in that company. But that was fun just to be a part of the show and see everybody do well. And this sounds really dumb. I don't even think I was booked for the second one, was I? No, I wasn't.
No, I don't believe you were.
Awesome. That started the trend.
Well, which is weird because, you know, you obviously were set to be, and that was our next topic, is the revival of ECW in 2006. And that came like a week after One Night Stand. And you were a part of that early on, so it's kind of weird that they didn't have you on the actual show. But it seemed like that the second show was less of a reunion and more of just meant to be the launching pad for the new program, whereas the first one was more of just supposed to be just a one-time kind of revival. But when they started talking about ECW coming back full-time, what were your expectations? Did you think it was maybe, you know, they were going to let it ride and let Heyman really run it and be what it could be, or did you think they were going to screw it up from the start?
You know, Paul didn't think that much of me then. He was a big CM Punk supporter, and that's fine, you know, because that's, you know, Punk's a great talent, but he didn't want to have anything to do with guys like me and Danny Doring and certain guys, and you know, that's his choice. He was in control, and he didn't see us as talents anymore, and that's fine. I wasn't on ECW TV for, like, the first however many months, and then they acted like I was. I, you know, one thing about wrestling that's funny is I always tried to tell them this, like, you know, if I'm not on TV and I'm not wrestling every week or wrestling regularly, people don't think, hey, he's just not booked. People think, well, he's lazy. He just doesn't want to wrestle. He doesn't like it. He just comes and goes wherever he pleases. Because that's what I thought when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. Didn't you guys kind of think that? Like, oh, he just kind of comes and goes. He's not really somebody I want to care about.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely growing up, for sure.
Yeah. When you don't see a guy for like 3 months, you know, you didn't have dirt sheets or any of that kind of jazz back then. So you didn't know guys making movies and, you know, why was Hulk Hogan not on camera for 6 months? He's probably pumping iron or tanning on the beach or something like that. So when you're, yeah, I agree. I agree with you 100% that, you know, when you're a kid, you don't catch those kind of things until you're older.
Do you think ECW could have worked, or do you think it was doomed from the start? Regardless of what you saw, thought then, just kind of looking back at it now, do you think there's any chance it could have survived in that atmosphere?
No, it could have been whatever they wanted it to be. Like I said, it's a fake subjective business. If Vince wanted to make $1 billion with ECW, he could have. If Vince wanted to just have one night stand and never use it again, he could have. If he wanted to make it the number one show and replace it, you know, replace Raw with that on Monday nights, he could. It's not up to whatever. It's just his decision or whoever's decision is in charge of any company, and that's the way it's going to be. The fans don't really matter.
Which is sad, but I guess that's the way it goes.
Even though we as fans are the ones that make the ultimate decision.
Do you agree? You'll watch. Hey, man, I asked somebody at Comic-Con. Somebody at Comic-Con goes, asked me a question about the state of the business and why the show sucks so much and they can't stand to watch it every week. And I said, well, let me ask you a question. Why do you keep watching it? Mm-hmm. And they went, well, I don't know. And I go, well, you know, here's an analogy. If I watch The Office, which is one of my favorite shows, and I watch it and, wow, this show's starting to suck, I'm going to stop watching it. I'm not going to watch it every week hoping, oh my God, I hope season 100 is better than season 99. I've been watching it for 100 years. No, I stop watching it. That's how you tell Vince and Dixie and all these people in charge that, hey, your show sucks. I don't like it. Stop watching it. Mm-hmm. If you like it, watch it. I'm not telling you not to.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and Scott and I have always kind of shared the same opinion that we know we're going to always watch. And we always try our whole slant on things. Is, you know, we look for the best. We try not to be overly negative. We know there's things we're not going to agree with. And it stinks, like you said, when there is something that could work, but, you know, they don't listen to the fans. They do it on their own. But it's just something we've always grown up with and always loved. And it's just always going to be part of, I think, what we watch. I mean, at least at this point in my life, that's how I feel. So tell us a little bit about the final years, if there's any specific memories from there coming out of ECW, then you went back to SmackDown for a little while before you left the promotion in 2008. Any kind of memories of those last couple years?
No, not really.
Yeah.
No, just collecting a check and working and keeping myself in shape and really trying to think and pray on what I'm going to do next because, yeah, you know, it's just I see the writing on the wall and maybe I'll get an office job or a trainer job out of this, but you know, I just, they kind of, when you're not figured in or you're not one of their favorites or one of their new toys or whatever, you're just, you know, you're just being paid for your misery. I don't know if you ever heard that from anybody else. You're just being paid for your misery. That's all it is. And you know, you can't do anything about it. Cause how much harder could I, if I worked any harder, I would have had a friggin' heart attack.
Yeah.
You know, did any more cardio, trained any harder, had any more matches and tried to offer. I moved to Connecticut for the company so I could be there to go to the office and be available. And they never took advantage of that either. I always volunteered to do different stuff, but they already had an opinion of me and it was never, ever going to change.
So you leave WWE, kind of go through the independents. You had suffered and recovered from a collapsed lung. Mm-hmm. You wrestled for NWA No Limits. You had wrestled in Maryland. Then in February of 2009, you've mentioned it's good to get to this part now because you've kind of alluded to them often so far tonight. And that is you went to TNA. You were Dr. Stevie. You were the anonymous at the beginning doctor for Abyss, which led to feuds with Raven and Raven coming back, you know, being in TNA, working with him again, and then Mick Foley. And how did it start to that you arrived at TNA?
Terry Taylor. He pretty much gave me a lot of my jobs in the business. He gave me my job at WWE, WCW, TNA. I had an idea that Abyss had a therapist. I gave them that idea before I was even released, and they started to talk about a therapist. And it was kind of funny that after I got released, I was started to talk to Terry, and I said I would be the perfect one because I'm a fan of the American Psycho movies. No, the one movie, not the second one. Not the police.
I agree. The second one was terrible.
I'm a fan of that character, and that was the character I wanted to play. Somebody that is, you know, maybe when you look at them, they're normal. And especially in a therapist position, you figure that guy's going to be normal and giving therapy to crazy people like Abyss and Daphne. But when it turns out that guy, Dr. Stevie, is crazier than everybody. And it took a while for me to, and it never came to fruition in the end with Jarrett and all these other people. I was trying to convince them that the real monsters of the world, because they would say, well, you don't look like a monster. You don't look like this. You don't look like that. I go, but the real monsters of the world are the Gacy's, are the Dahmers, are the Bundys, are the people that look even more normal than me. The people that babysit your kids, the people that get your mail for you, these kinds of things. And that's what Dr. Stevie could be. And they didn't get that because I wasn't 520,000 pounds or something.
Who came up with that gimmick? You had mentioned it, but was that kind of an idea you had spawned in your head and went to them with it?
No, they came up with that. I'm pretty sure it was either Vince Russo or Jarrett or both of them, and Dr. Stevie. And, you know, Dale Oliver wrote a great entrance theme for me, and he's a great writer for the music there, and he really got the, you know, for the first time, I think, in my whole career, there was an entrance song that really captured my character and was really just made for me. So I mean, that's a little off topic, but I want to thank him. I mean, him and his wife wrote a song that was for me, and that's pretty damn cool.
Now, you have gone through, again, with all the promotions, so many different types of venues, atmospheres, obviously the ECW arena, maybe one that could probably never be duplicated anywhere, to those small Southern arenas in WCW, to obviously the arenas when you were at WWE, and then you go to this Impact Zone, which is in essence kind of like a warehouse almost. What was that like? Was that a kind of different? Did it have that ECW arena kind of feel because of the size, or what was that like? Kind of being in that kind of atmosphere, that different kind of Impact Zone atmosphere.
Well, I knew I had a challenge because you have basically the same people in there all the time, or people that aren't familiar with the product. They're just being shuffled in from the park for free. But I saw that as an advantage because, just like I said before, everybody in TNA was trying to do cool stuff. Everybody in TNA, even the heels, were trying to get their catchphrases over, were trying to do stuff. And the Dr. Stevie character, which I channeled sort of like the Right to Censor Steven Richards character, that there was a lot of elements of that in there, where I wasn't cool, where I was just a jerk. I didn't ever laugh or smile. I was just looked miserable. I looked very serious, and people didn't like it. And of course, you know, paired with Abyss and treating Abyss like a piece of garbage, it makes it a lot easier for them to want him to just completely destroy me. And you know, we had that match at Victory Road, and it was kind of funny because we were arguing over it because they wanted it to be a 50-50 match, and I was just like completely doing all this stuff to him for so many weeks and months. I said, you know, I can do a little stuff here and there, but this is the payoff. We talked about the payoffs, pay-per-view, Victory Road. This is the payoff. This is where the people get to see him completely just beat the shit out of me and beat me bloody and I get color and all this stuff happens. And then I tased him earlier that month. So have him tase me. Makes perfect sense. Just make sure I cut a promo so I'm just not like disappearing once again and, you know, going on vacation, shooting a movie and tanning like Hogan always did, you know. But yeah, I mean, it worked out perfect. I still got my heat back afterwards, but that match culminated in the crowd in the Impact Zone, which was dead up until that point, completely went crazy when the Abyss was just killing me. They loved it because they hated me.
Sounds easy, right?
It's very easy. People complicate it too much. Good versus evil. There's no gray area. I don't think there's a gray area.
No, I mean, like you said, the simplest story still can get the emotions going.
Listen, these people in the audience are not. These people in the audience aren't using the equipment we're using to do this podcast. These people aren't using audio recording software. These people are not putting tutorials up on YouTube like I am. These people aren't even dressing themselves properly every day. They need it dumbed down. If you want a smart rally, a smart show, go to the RH show. Go here. But when you're talking about major casual fans or major television exposure to casual fans, you want to simplify it. WWE, I think, is doing that in a way right now, but putting a little twist. TNA is just, I don't even know what the fuck they're doing.
You can't even tell who they're writing the show for anymore. I honestly don't know. And I don't know what they're trying to appeal to.
And not to sound, I don't want to sound like sarcastic. I mean, I know that's a little harsh for me to say it like that, but really, you know, it seems like every quarter you change the wrestling business forever. That becomes watered down after a while. Mm-hmm. You can't keep saying that.
Absolutely. And this was there was a time where they had the opportunity. And, you know, that night, I remember it just clear as day. And Justin and I have talked about it ad nauseum that night that Brett Hart came back on Raw and Bischoff and Hogan were on Impact the same night. I remember it was the first time in a while going to a friend's house or watching it collectively as a group, and you're like, wow, this is great. And then literally 20 minutes into that Impact, I'm like, oh, lovely.
It's
Nitro.
You know, if you go back 5-6 years ago is when they were really primed, really presenting a different, like Stevie said earlier, about presenting the complete opposite when they had the X Division cranking and AJ Styles and Samoa Joe, you know, they were using those guys to their strengths. And that was when they really seemed poised to become a legit kind of threat. And then they completely reversed field and tried to become WWE Light / Nitro. And it just never, you know, hasn't really worked out since. But they definitely had their chance and they just decided to back off instead of pushing forward with it. But so earlier this year, Steve, you left TNA. You did a little more indie work and then you started with Lucha Libre USA as an announcer. And in June, you turned heel once again. Of course, you helped out our boy, John Walters, who's under RJ Brewer, with his awesome anti-Mexican stable that he has going. And obviously, we are big John Walters fans here. We think
so am I. And so am I. I tried to get him a job at WWE. He's one of my favorite workers. He's great.
Immensely talented. And I think he's underrated by fans on the mic as well. When you watch some of the promo work he does in Lucha Libre USA, I think it's definitely top-notch stuff that he's been doing. And I always bust his balls because say it works because you're an asshole in real life. So, you know, he's playing the asshole on TV now, so it works out well. But
John and me have a lot in common, actually. He reminds me of me because, you know, I don't know if it's coming across in the interview, but just that no-nonsense, just plain spoken and just sort of a slightly cynical and sarcastic view on everything that, you know, no tolerance for any kind of bullshit that comes your way.
Yeah,
that's kind of the way I am.
Yep, we definitely get the same feel because we had him on, you know, a while ago, and it is the same exact style of interview as you, very forthright, very truthful, and like you said, no BS around it. And, you know, I'm glad to see him finally getting, you know, some national exposure in a gimmick, in a role that can really accentuate his strengths because he can go in the ring, but he also has a good base with mic work. And I do feel like he's someone that never really got the break he probably should have gotten. And we're actually going to go see him next month. He's facing Loki up in Mass, so we're looking forward to going to talk about
it. Help him.
he's been building it up, so hopefully it goes off well. We saw him last a couple years ago when he fought Just Incredible up there. Ric Flair as a referee. So whenever he comes to this area, I try and go catch up with him. So
yeah,
cool. So what do you think about Lucha Libre? You think it can be a long term success the way they do it with the different seasons on MTV?
Yeah, as long as that TV deal comes up, we put quite a few episodes in the can right now. I got to tell you, the season three, the end of season two with The Turn, and then season three, what we did first two episodes. Oh man, it's really good stuff, and the crowd is pretty hot. And at the Hard Rock the Hard Rock Casino in Albuquerque, John, me, PD Williams, John Recon, and then we have Billy Gunn in for the last one, but it's basically, John Recon, Billy, Petey Williams, me, and John, RJ Brewer. And, it really just, man, it just was such a great opportunity. The commentary in season two, I was sort of like a half babyface kind of commentator, and It was like, whatever. But the commentary on the season three stuff as a heel, where I can be the real true life fucking dick that I am. That's fun, where I just sit there and argue with Kevin Kelly and Alex about just stuff that really honestly bothers me about the business. I literally say, is these guys, these Mexicans are wrestling and they have no psychology. Right. Say on the mic. And I was like kidding around about one of the midget wrestlers, like Vladimiro, was very entertaining and very entertaining character. And I enjoyed him, but I was calling him like baby Dracula. Girls wrestled when it was over. I was like, oh my God, thank God that's over. I can be myself. And people will see some good stuff, and hopefully it'll come soon. And RJ and me, I look forward to working with him. I hope we get to work with each other and against each other, because he's one of the best guys I've ever worked on the indies. And it's a good opportunity. They take care of you, man. They put you up in a hotel at the Hard Rock. There's a good gym there, which means a lot to me. And they even give you food vouchers. So it's like, when I go, there's hardly any expense at all to go out there for TV for a couple of days.
That's what he was saying. He said he was almost surprised when he received the offer the first time, the package that they put together. And it's good to have an alternative. And I think the crowds are really hot. From what, the first couple of seasons, because I always make it a point, obviously, to watch to support him. So I was definitely getting into it. Like you said, the crowd, it's definitely a different style of crowd, a different presentation. Very just a classic wrestling promotion. We got into that in depth with him quite a bit.
I mentioned two other guys. Definitely Mark Jindrak, because he's top babyface there, and he's doing well, and he's a Mexican. I mean, he's a star, man, in Mexico. He does a ton of stuff. He has his own cologne coming out. He writes a children's book. He's all over. Wrestling's like number four. That's how he's transcended in Mexico. But there's a guy, Rocky Romero. I know you guys know him from ROH.
Yes.
He's not only one of my favorite wrestlers, and we got the opportunity to wrestle in the first episode of season three, or the second episode, I think, of season three. And I was so nervous, because I'm such a big fan of his work and everything he did in ROH. But I'm an even bigger fan of Rocky as a person, because he's a really nice, gracious guy and fun to be around. And, just somebody you don't hear a whole lot about, but he should, people should book that guy, because he's really, really good and such a nice, positive influence to have in the locker room.
Now, do we have a start date yet for season three?
No, I don't. I don't want to be quoted on it. Okay. We're hoping for September, I think. But I'm just hoping. I mean, we're booked at the end of August for the next two or three episodes. So they keep booking us and keep taping them. So, cool. And they're not irrelevant. It's not like, I have green hair, or, I've gained 120 pounds, I'm going to look different from episode 5 to 6. It's nothing like that.
Yeah. Well, we're definitely going to try and be the first major podcast to cover Lucha Libre USA kind of diligently, because we want to give you guys, as much coverage as we can. And we want to get as many people into it as we can, because the more alternatives, the better. And of course, friends of ours, you and John. So so what also led you to get into what you're doing now, the Connecticut School of Broadcasting, the T4 Tech Show? Obviously, you mentioned earlier, you've always kind of been a nerd at heart. What made you finally, say, this is something I want to do. This is something I think I could be good at, and go ahead and do it.
Well, I wanted to do tech reviews for WWE.com way, way back. And I remember Brian Kalinowski was the head of New Media. I think they called it New Media back then for the website. And I gave him the pitch, and it was like a lot of the concepts I still use today with T4 Show, about covering all this stuff and just bringing in a different demographic. A lot of these people, are geeky kids that like comic books and all this other stuff and cell phones, and it would bring a different element to the site, a lot of traffic. And he goes, oh yeah, and when you're reviewing a cell phone, Ken Anderson comes in, or Mr. Kennedy, whatever he was back then, comes in and he grabs it and he hits you over the head with it and knocks you out. And I'm like, well, what the fuck are you talking about? stupidest idea I've ever heard. So I just did the old I'll show you, you'll see, and said, you know what? I'm going to create this thing on my own. And this started around January 2007. I'm going to start it on my own. And as a matter of fact, I don't want to be known as Stevie Richards. I don't want the crutch of wrestling. I don't want the negative wrestling fans to just kind of try to ruin everything. The one talked about that just always bitch at everything. I want to be Michael Manna. I want to keep it on the down low and just try to build relationships with these companies to review stuff. And I'm just going to try to build my own body of work. That way, if it is successful, I don't feel like, it's only because I used that Stevie Richards name in the WWE or whatever. And if I fail, it's because I didn't try hard enough and it's all on me. So I think it's been a success. You know, I got my co-host Colm. He brings great energy. He's a very talented art director, and he brings that talent to the show. And we just try to cover everything in technology. And I just try to do everything that I normally do throughout the day and just record it with a video camera or, you know, screencast it so I can pass some knowledge along to anybody. So I hope you guys have checked it out and you enjoy it. And I enjoy doing it. So I hope I don't bore people to tears.
No, never. Very engaging, obviously, not only in this, but in that as well. And why don't you just let our listeners know, you know, how often the show's put on, or is it specific days and times? Just let them know where they can check it out.
Oh, yeah. It's t4show.com. T as in Tom, the number 4show.com. Has everything, tech stuff, has fitness tutorials. So if you're looking to get into shape, obviously, you can go to there and or go to the playlist on YouTube.com/T4Show videos. It's not just a little 30-second thing or whatever. I have full workouts on there. So if you want to learn how to work out safely and fun, and God, I can't even talk at the end of this. You figured, no wonder WWE didn't give me a microphone.
Not at all.
If you want a fun and safe workout and an easier way to do everything, because I don't do anything that's difficult, I have full workout videos on there. And I do weekly ones of that, but also tech stuff, comic books, which we just came from Comic-Con. So I'm going to talk about that. And we do the live show every Wednesday. The other shows, the comic show, the app show, and the other stuff that we do sort of floats around on days. But that live show Wednesday nights, 9 p.m., covers all the tech news, reviews, and different stuff throughout the 60 to 90 minute window of the show.
Awesome. So definitely Place to Be Nation. Check that out. Support Stevie. So what we want to do to kind of wrap up is we have a few listener questions that we put out there on the different pages to gather some feedback. So we'll let Scott go ahead and fire off the first one for you.
Okay.
Okay.
The first of our listeners asks, now you were involved in both of the current promotions, hardcore get-togethers, if you will. Obviously, we had mentioned you were at the first One Night Stand in 2005, and you were at TNA's Hardcore Justice, and you were part of that the faction, blanked out. Yes, thank you. I totally blanked out. What was the difference between the two? What did you like about one or the other? Being involved in both of them.
Oh, I don't think anything would ever match the Hammerstein Ballroom of the 2005 one. They're two different things. You know, the EV 2.0, it's kind of weird how I was backstage and they were talking about this is your last stand and this is this and all of this finality kind of talk. And I'm like, what are you guys talking about? I'm not retiring. I'm in the best shape of my life. I don't look like these guys. These guys are freaking messes. I'm not a mess. I go, I'm under contract. Are you firing me? You know, it was like really weird. Like I felt like I was going to get euthanized as soon as the paper went off the air.
Oh, it's
really weird. And you know, I mean, short answer, that One Night Stand 2005, it has to be one of the best pay-per-views atmosphere wise, on DVD. Even you can feel the atmosphere of all time, bar none, bar any wrestling and no WrestleMania, nothing else. The atmosphere of that building with that show, I don't think can be matched.
All right, next question. Being an ECW alum, who do you think has the more extreme or more loyal fans, New York or Philadelphia?
Oh, it's got to be Philadelphia. And I don't know what loyal, if you mean in a positive or negative way. I have to say Philadelphia. New York takes it now because that arena has been so bastardized with all different promotions. But a Hammerstein Ballroom used to be the arena. I would say 94 to 97 would be Philadelphia for ECW. Mm-hmm. And then I'd say Hammerstein took it over after that. And Hammerstein has it now at ROH.
Right. And of course, Hammerstein was where that 97 Raw we spoke about earlier. That was just cool that they went back to the, well, that was in the Manhattan Center, but that's the same building, correct?
Yeah, it's right there. Manhattan Center and the Hammerstein Ballroom's not from there.
So,
yeah. Vince McMahon said that you were great at putting guys over and making them look good. One of our listeners says, do you think that's a double-edged sword? Because on the one hand, you're great at your job and your boss appreciates your work, but at the same time, you have a role and you pretty much stay in that role. Our listener asks if you feel that's a double-edged sword.
Absolutely. Yeah, I do. I was always frustrated with that because if you're a good worker, that means you're a good worker on both sides of the coin. And, you know, hardly anybody's going to buy a t-shirt or an action figure or want to play a guy in a video game who loses, matches. And we're not talking about like the Mulkeys we kind of laugh about. And we always remember a guy who looks like he should win some matches and doesn't. That makes me look even worse. Yeah. I always wondered why guys that weren't talented and maybe didn't even have any more of a look than I did just got pushed. And I always thought there was some sort of sinister reason. If it doesn't add up, there's got to be something really messed up going on that I'm not aware of, you know, in backstage kind of stuff. Because it logically and business-wise, it just doesn't add up. So, yeah, I know I should have went further in the business as far as with my talent. But because I was so giving and just wanted to have a good match and proved – the way I worked the match was, you tell me what you want, tell me what you do well, tell me what you're comfortable with, and in my mind, I can formulate a match around you and then put my stuff in there. That's the way I work. And unfortunately, more times than not, it would be to put somebody over. So yeah, double-edged sword, but you know what? I could have been made a good amount of money for 3 years in WWE and been let go, but I made a good amount of money in WWE and I was there 9 years and had to put my ego aside for those 9 years.
Okay. So, next question comes in, says, how do you feel about Joey Styles' moniker for you? The Clueless Putz.
I felt fine with it. It made me stand out from everybody else. Just like I said before, I don't take it. The Stevie Richards character, you cannot hurt his feelings because Michael Manna isn't the Stevie Richards character.
Right.
You know, you said something personal about me. Well, that still wouldn't bother me because I don't care, but you say something about the Stevie Richards character. That's what I was. I'm not going to sit there with Daisy Dukes, with my balls hanging out half shirt in an 80s hair band and go, oh, well, how can you call me that? Yeah, of course you should. You should call me a lot more than that.
Where do you think Joey Styles ranks as far as all-time this announcers? Just doing the good job putting the product over and coming across legitimately.
I don't know. I follow Fake Girl on Twitter, and I forget what a great commentator at Gorilla Monsoon is.
Oh, Fake Gorilla is awesome. Do you follow Fake Hacksaw Jim Duggan as well?
I do. He had quite a few at the Comic-Con. I followed Dixie Carter Nod. I asked her why I couldn't get a raise a few times. TNA Creative. All different people.
Yeah,
I
there's some good ones on there.
Yeah, the fake Chris Benoit can be a little dark at times, but I don't really pay attention to his tweets too much.
No, I do not. I knew there was a zombie Chris Benoit. Yeah. Is there a video as well?
No, you know, he doesn't exist anymore, by the way.
Yeah.
This whole part is going to be blacked out of this podcast.
I forgot the question already.
It was just what you thought about Joey Styles as an announcer.
I think Joe, I don't think anybody ranks anywhere. I think, you know, some of my favorite announcers that are the ones, JR, and this is no particular order, JR, Joey. I think today when he was the third announcer that gave the technical moves and stuff like that was at his very best.
Yes.
When he came in as the analyst. I think that's great. And I, you know, being in Lucha Libre and being part of a 3-man commentary team, I think those work very well. I think Kevin Kelly is severely underrated. Kevin Kelly is one of my favorites because I'm watching him work at Lucha Libre. I can see how he thinks on the fly, and how he basically does my commentary for me. That's a great commentator. Joey did the same thing, and JR does the same thing. He will basically throw a softball to you every single time. That's how you know it's good commentary, because he's actually commentating for two people.
As a fan, too, someone I always liked, and I talk about this a lot in the shows, was Tony Schiavone. And I feel like he got ruined those last few years at WCW. Just kind of became cynical, and I think he just kind of got beaten down by the whole process. And I think everyone remembers that era, but they forget the – and you probably appreciate this as growing up as an NWA fan as well. Vintage Tony in the NWA and early kind of WCW era, I think is severely underrated by a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tony's great too. I didn't mention him, but it was right along with Mike Tenay and the three person team. Bobby Heenan was awesome too with Gorilla. You know, there's a lot of good commentators. Not easy to do, not easy to do at all. I mean, I wouldn't say Ernest Miller really ranks up there. I think Taz has his own thing, even though he mispronounces just about every friggin' word that comes out of his mouth.
Well, that one, Taz and Michael Cole together at that one point, they were really in a good groove in the early 2000s.
Yeah, Michael Cole's really good. But they were friends, and they knew each other outside, and they went to the gym together at Titan Towers. And, you know, when you get to know each other, it's like, you know, me and John Walters talking in the back and just burying everything. That's, you know, talking about whatever. It's like me talking to Danny Doring. That's two guys on the couch watching the show, just giving their opinions off the cuff. That's a good commentary team.
And when you were mentioned about the way you commentate in Lucha Libre, it actually brought back memories of how Jesse Ventura used to be.
That's who I want to be.
Yes, you definitely accomplished that. I hope you realize it. Because as soon as you were saying it, that is exactly what I thought of. And just a guy who goes out there and says what he feels and lets loose. But comes across legitimately. Doesn't come across as a joke or whine. You know, it makes everything seem realistic and legitimate. So if that's your goal, you're definitely reaching it.
Well, the thing is, hopefully with this interview too, you know, I give my opinion, I'm forthright, just like with the commentary, but I'm not going out of my way to bury anybody or be negative to a point where it's like I'm trying so hard. I don't just throw out lines of meanness, you know, for the sake of it. You know, there's certain times where, you know, I'll be mean in the commentary, but I'll say I am a fan of Rocky Romero's work, but it's a shame he's Mexican. Who cares? They say, no, he's not Mexican. You know, Spanish, and that was the difference. I don't know if they're going to clear me hitting with a bag of oranges in the next show. I want to do that.
Oh, I hope they clear it.
That'd be awesome.
It's wrestling. Let it fly. Come on.
Who cares? Exactly.
That might keep the TV deal from going through.
Another one of our listeners asked, in terms of the creative approach to producing a show, you were in, of course, both WWE. They specifically mentioned WWE and TNA. Obviously, the one, and I'm kind of amending this, the one constant of both was obviously Vince Russo, at least in the early part when you arrived in 99. What is the differences, our listeners asking, about the process of producing a show in WWE and in TNA?
I wasn't really privy to being on the inner circle of each. It was kind of funny being there, you know, obviously I assume Vince had the last word and everything. In TNA, I think it's a lot more like WCW, where you have a lot of hands in that book, and it comes through on TV, I think. I used to kid around, and sometimes with WWE, because you didn't know who to talk to, you didn't know who to pitch an idea to, because the writers always said they weren't responsible for that show or this or that. I renamed World Wrestling Entertainment into Al-Qaeda Entertainment, because there were sleeper cells that didn't know how the other sleeper cells operated. You didn't know when they were going to be activated, and TNA sort of turned into that too. See, this kind of stuff the guy could have got on TV. It just, nobody knew that Stevie Richards existed, I guess.
Mm. All right, now this next one, if you want to avoid, you let me know. We tried to keep this mostly positive, but this is from a listener. Why is it that a lot of guys that jump ship to TNA after being released from WWE, and he gives examples of Billy Gunn and the Dudleys, had such negative things to say about Triple H? Did you ever have an issue with him during your time there? And again, if you don't want to get into this, you don't have to. Just let us know.
I never had an issue with Triple H, and I just never, I never got along with him to the point of to be friends, but I never had an issue with him professionally or personally. As a matter of fact, a lot of times I asked him workout advice because he's a huge, I mean, you know, people can make fun of him and say like sometimes he doesn't look as good as others, but the guy's on the road 300 days a year. He goes into Stanford, he runs the, he helps run the company. Mm-hmm. And he still does get to the gym. He's a huge bodybuilding fan. He works out. He knows a lot about dieting. And sometimes I would pick his brain about that, but that would be the extent of it. Or I would ask him a question about wrestling. People don't understand. It's not like, I'm a very anti-drama person. I don't like confrontations, you know, that aren't necessary. And there's no reason for me to like nor dislike Hunter. I respect his work, and I don't know him as a person. So, you know, that's pretty much the gist of it. I think what he's done is amazing. Mm-hmm. I think what he's done in this business is amazing. He's pretty much, and people can say he's just because he's Stephanie's husband or he's banging the boss's daughter, as people like to so crudely put. Mm-hmm. But what would you do? Let me ask you, if you wanted to be a wrestler and you wanted to be in WWE and it was your dream, yet you are in love with this woman who happens to be Vince McMahon's daughter, and now you're going to go to Vince McMahon and tell him, hey, I've been dating your daughter. What do you think might happen?
It could be one thing or the other.
Yeah, he took probably the biggest chance of anybody in his career. So, yeah. You know, for anybody to say, hey, he doesn't love Stephanie, well, you know, he pretty much almost say, because Vince could have just said, you're fired, you're never working anywhere again, and he's done.
Right, or God forbid something happens, a divorce or unfaith, you know, you're burying your whole career. So, yeah, to people say he's just taking that risk just to get ahead. Definitely seems far-fetched, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm actually going to defer to Justin, because you and I talked about this earlier. I'm not sure which one of our listeners is how this question is supposed to be worded, but what is the common opinion for non WWE performers?
I think he means about Triple H, but I think we're done talking about Triple H.
We don't talk about Triple H anymore. Okay. When you first came into the question from a listener, when you first came into the World Wrestling Federation, you were doing the imitation gimmick. Who was your favorite guy to imitate?
I'm trying to think back. I don't even know. I don't know that I had a favorite. It didn't have the same feel as ECW. I'd have to say none.
Who was your favorite ECW one to imitate?
The favorite one was probably, I'm trying to think back. The Kiss one was really cool.
Yes.
That was really cool. And I was unexpected. That's when we started to turn babyface, because we were heels before that. And the Baron Von Stevie one was entertaining. And I fought that one all the way. Raven convinced me it would be great. And, you know, I didn't believe him. I said, this is kind of stupid. Exactly. And, you know, he was right. And those two things are probably, you know, the Fabulous ones was cool, but a lot of people don't get it. But the Baron Von Stevie one was very, you know, bald cap and a cape and trying to put the claw on Joey Styles and he just walks away. That thing. And the Kiss stuff. Yeah, Kiss. It would probably have to be Kiss. I'm trying to think back to what I did. There was a lot of stuff every week we did on ECW. It was cool.
All right. Was there, going back quickly to the RTC days, were there supposed to be any other members that ended up getting nixed or not involved that you can remember?
No. They pretty much went the way it did. You know, we didn't have too many characters outside of the ones we had that needed to be repackaged for, you know, PG material at the time. I just wish it went further. I think the RTC or something, RTC type character could still, I mean, it's just it hits a raw nerve. You could bring that kind of character back to the show at any time to take away something that people like and make an instant heel out of anybody.
Were you happy that you were not straddled with the white tugboat pants and Val Venus was?
I don't understand. I think they were going to make him the leader at one point, and I don't know why that didn't come to fruition. You know, you don't ask him if you ever get him on the interview.
It just seemed very strange that he was just given these random white pants.
He definitely looked like he should be selling ice cream more than fighting.
He should have a little paper hat on his head. It was just very strange that you guys were all very uniform, and here is him with these white pants. It was very, very weird.
I never understood why. I have to ask him why.
another listener asks, how scared were you after the Heidenreich electric chair bump you pretty much were dropped right on your neck, and they said it looked pretty brutal.
Yeah, I was scared. Yeah, I was scared. And I did. Somebody emailed a YouTube link a while back, and I read a couple of comments where people are saying that I took it wrong or I did something, and I kind of tried to blame. And that's what it's funny about it. That was the third week I wrestled Heidenreich. The first week he separated my shoulder. Second week he did something else to my other shoulder, and then they put it. And that's when I said, you know, Tommy literally came up to me after the match where he dropped me on my head, and thank God I didn't. It broke a bone in my neck, and I stayed on the road for a while. And you know, the company wasn't exactly, you know, trying to rush me to the hospital to get looked at or anything. I wasn't too happy about that part. But Tommy goes, you know, Stevie, I really do think that this company is legitimately trying to kill you.
Definitely for that 2-year stretch, it definitely seemed that way.
Yeah.
Said.
You have the next one. Yes, yep. You have the next one.
So who is your favorite person to work with during the new ECW on Sci-Fi?
Punk. I worked Punk quite a bit. So we had some really good matches. We had good chemistry. So, and you know,
did you see him being the star he is right now?
No, because he didn't fit the bill and, you know, of what they wanted. I see him as going as far as Paulie gave him the launch pad for, and always being in the mix because he's a very competent worker. And he had that, he had the label put on him that he was going to be in the mix from the very beginning. But I never saw him being this because obviously he wasn't allowed to be up until that point.
Right.
So, you know, they could have, they can just as easily have him get squashed next week and disappear.
I think everyone is just waiting for it, to be honest.
And it very well may happen.
Yeah. Hopefully not.
Yeah. Another one of our listeners asks, what were your best memories and road stories with the very underrated Crash Holly?
Oh God. Yeah. He was, I had a question a lot at the Comic-Con. It was great that people remember him because he was probably the most fun and the most stressful to every drive with. He, you know, when he was going through his personal issues and going through his divorce, he lived at my house and he mowed my initials in my lawn and took up the show it to me. He did a lot of things. I never knew what I was coming home to from the road, but it was always going to be something that would cost me money and potentially just, you know, make me lose my homeowner's insurance. Yeah, I love that. I thought that was great. It always kept me entertained. And he's somebody, I miss a lot of guys because we've lost a lot of people, but Crash is somebody. And sometimes I talk to Tommy and he'll just say, I miss Crash. And, you know, because he was real tight with Crash too. And it just, man, I can go on and on about just how people like him should, you know, not outside with the demons, but in the ring and the way they entertain. Those are the things that are missing from professional wrestling today, those kind of characters.
Of course, who could ever forget the great 24/7 hardcore stuff that he was, you know, really known for in the WWF. Was always a very entertaining part of Raw. Okay, so we got two questions left here. Now we're going to put you on the spot, Stevie. What's the favorite match of your career?
My next one.
Good answer. I like it.
Yes. And this one, this last question somebody asked, and I kind of relate to it because it kind of relates to me as well. You threw a perfect game with the MLB 2K11.
Mm-hmm.
The closest I ever got was a three-hitter. I've tried my butt off, and I just can't. It's not easy, folks, so... this man deserves a lot of credit because I have the game, and it's you could be anybody. You could be CC Sabathia. It doesn't matter who your pitcher is. A perfect game is almost impossible.
Who did you use for that game, Stevie? Who was your pitcher?
Roy Halladay. First game of my franchise of the season. I had everything on default, which is pro, by the way. You know that, right? It's default on pro.
Yep.
You know what's funny is it's hard because they patched the game twice after I did it, and people call it the Michael Mana patch.
But you did it right when the game came out, right? Or right after the game came out. And
March 8th. Yeah.
Yep. And so you were, what, about 4 weeks too soon? Because the contest for the $1 million was, what, April 1st, right, when the season started. So that's still, does that still irk you?
No, it doesn't irk me. What's weird is the year before it was like the contest started on the day the game came out. Their rules were pretty simple. Then I guess, the reason why they have this $1 million contest, let's be honest, because MLB The Show is so far superior game and they're trying to sell copies so people can try to win this money. And, you know, it was just kind of weird how they these rules, which were 4 pages on a PDF. I don't know if you read the rules. They're crazy. And all I wanted to do was record an inning of gameplay for T4 Show and then record another inning. I recorded an inning of gameplay, and then I just kind of left my laptop connected to the HD PVR, and I started kept playing. And then it got to like the 7th or 8th inning. Then they started to say, like, the commentary on the 7th inning goes, well, he's about to do something, but we don't want to jinx it. And I'm like, what are they talking about? And I looked up and I'm like, oh, man, I go. And then they ended it right near the end of the 8th inning is when I started recording, because I said, wow, this is going to be great to put up on the site, but there's no way this is going to happen. And I said, well, they've been biting on sinkers the entire time. I started out with some cut fastballs and mixing them up with a curve, you know, because you know how to pitch in the game anyway. So, you know, you just try to mix them up and mix your locations. Yep. And they were just biting on sinkers like crazy. I was putting them in the dirt. And that last inning, you saw it on the YouTube video. And that was it. Perfect game. And you saw the achievement come up. So if it wasn't on pro, if it was on rookie, that achievement would not happen because the achievement is a perfect game in pro or better.
Right.
On difficulty. Right. 2K was weird because I wanted to, you know, I didn't care about the money, you know, although it would have been great to get, but I thought it'd be a great social media thing because they were in spring training, demoing the game and doing all this stuff. And I said, well, I can come down to Florida, down to Jupiter. I live in Tampa, and we can have me play the game, and you can do a bunch of press or do whatever you want. I don't care about the money. You make me like an ambassador for the game. And they never got back to me, and never. And they, it's actually the only mainstream press that the game ever got. When the guy got the perfect game, it was like a little blurb somewhere that some guy wanted like a month ago. But if you think about it, the only thing you hear when you hear MLB 2K11, you hear about that wrestler that pitched the perfect game, right? That's the first thing people say.
No doubt.
Yep.
Now, what team were you going against? Nationals?
It was the first game, so it was the Astros.
Oh, Astros. Okay. So just as inept an offense as Washington was.
Yeah. Everything was default. Like, it wasn't like I picked this matchup.
Right, yep.
Phillies versus the Royals or some shitty team. I was just like, I'm starting my franchise and I'm going to play, you know, sit down and play for, I don't know, 36 hours straight or whatever I do when I get into a game. Yeah, it was weird how they crawled under a rock and they disappeared, and they were blocking people on Twitter that were complaining. And then it turned into that I was, and you know, I was, what's the word I'm looking for? I was trying to enlist Twitter and all these people and these fans to get the $1 million for me. Like, I was begging for money. No, I didn't say a word. And it's just so weird how people just think the absolute worst. And because it's boring for me to say I didn't want it, I just wanted to put the video up on YouTube. Then it's the end of the story. But people want to dramatize it like I'm, you know, bitching and throwing my rocks at 2K Sports windows for my $1 million like a crybaby.
Well, now that we know you're a big Phillies fan here, we might have to have you back on, wrap up the baseball season, because our buddy Scott is a big Mets fan. So seems like we may have a little bit of a rivalry brewing here.
No, there's none. No, there is no rivalry. Not right now. Maybe eventually, but
it's a WWE TNA rivalry.
Oh, please. Oh, God. I hope I can get out of the abyss of that. No pun intended.
What's your prediction, Stevie? Are they going to win it all?
I think they're going to do what every Philly team does. They go right till near the end, and then they just burn out or they choke.
Are you an Eagles fan?
Yes, I am.
Ugh. Worse than being a Phillies fan. No, I'm just kidding.
Scott's a Cowboys fan. So
I'm a Cowboys fan. So.
You guys have a lot of issues.
Hey, Doring and a bunch of my really good friends are Doring and Nova and a couple other wrestlers I know are Cowboys fans, which I don't quite understand.
I don't get it either.
Oh, jeez. Anyway, I wanted to continue the video game talk for just a second. The next 3 months, obviously, you know, are pretty packed with crazy debut or releases. Next month is, I believe, the third Gears of War. October is Arkham City, the second Batman. And then now I'm blanking out. I think November is the newest Modern Warfare, Call of Duty Modern Warfare. Have you heard anything about any of these as they're coming out? I love the first two Gears of War. They were awesome. Have you heard anything about any of them?
I haven't heard about that, but we are a T4 show. We're getting a preview copy of Deus Ex. I can't pronounce it. I never could, but it's a good game, even though I can't pronounce it. And that looks really good. Gears of War, I'm kind of into that. I'm more into the sports games anyway, because you'll agree with me with the baseball and with the football and stuff. You never play the same game twice. And if you play the same person all the time, it becomes so, like, you know, every play counts, every pitch counts, because you get behind by a run. It's so hard because you're so familiar with each other's offense and defense and the way you guys play. Mm-hmm. I really think that's great. But when you go through a shooter game like Call of Duty and all this stuff, I went through it and that's it. And then I play online and everybody cheats the same way and I get pissed off because someone's camping out. They got a high ping rate and they're just, you know, that's, you can't do that with sports. You just, right. Either you can play or you can't play.
I was a little sad that Madden's coming out a little bit later this year. I was kind of ready to get it. Usually it comes out around this week.
Well, you should play NCAA because that's a great game, because you play you can have your player throughout high school. I started my guy in high school.
I just did it too. Yeah, I did it too.
Quarterback Michael Madden is very good. You have to watch out because he's coming to Madden. As Danny Dorian would say, the 6'6", 280-pound quarterback with long blonde hair who can run a 3.5 40.
Now, does he wear the Daisy Dukes, though? That's the question.
Yes. He's bigger than a lineman. He can't be stopped.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, well, I just did the high school myself on the 12 for the 360.
Surprised you remember high school, Scott.
Did you pre-order Madden? If you pre-order Madden at GameStop, pre-order it when you buy NCAA, you get an automatic guaranteed $30 trade-in for NCAA, plus those the Pro Bowl uniforms for Madden.
Oh, okay. Good tip from Stevie there for all the gamers.
Yeah. I saw that. I saw that ad. Yeah, you get the Pro Bowl teams. You can use them in a season, I think, too, which is you can actually like lay everybody out for 16 games, which is probably.
Yeah, but more importantly, stuff. You get the $30 trading credit from NCAA when you get Madden.
Right.
So it's usually around 18 to 21 bucks, so you get extra money. And then if you got the power-up card, you get an extra 20%, I think.
Yes.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, I have that as well. I have the power-up card.
Nice. Well, Stevie, we want to thank you so much for being so gracious with your time here, spending a lot of time with us talking about your career wrestling and, of course, some of your video game stuff and tech stuff and everything else. And we'd love to have you back on once Lucha Libre starts firing up and kind of talk about that. And I want to have you on again and just talk about stuff as a fan, you know, this different shows and different memories now that we've kind of gone through your career and gotten familiar with you. So we hope you would like to join us again sometime soon.
No, I appreciate you guys. You guys did a great interview. This is kind of why, I don't do too many of them because most of them take that negative turn or they expect it to be sensational, and I'm not that way. So you guys asked some really good questions. The fans asked very good questions, very intelligent questions. I appreciate that too.
Well, thank you. We appreciate it. And thank you. Yes, we'd love to talk to you again soon. We're going to, I'll go ahead and tweet this interview towards you once we get it posted, so that way you can send it out to your fans as well. Of course, as always, Place to Be Nation, thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. We will be back later this week with our Vintage Vault. This Tuesday in Texas we're up to. And hopefully we'll be back as well, maybe with a SummerSlam recap too. So once again, for my PIC, Scott Criscolo, and the man, Stevie Richards, thank you for listening. We'll talk to you later this week.
Peace.